Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of The League of Mediocre Gentlemen. I'm your host slash producer, Richard Martindale, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Ian Shaw.
The King in the North!
And Patrick Wiener.
Game of Thrones is so lame.
All right, guys. It's been 6 weeks since we did our last podcast.
How long has it been since the last one was posted?
It still hasn't been posted. It's actually in post-production right now, and I'm almost done with it. But,
Wow, and nothing in it will be relevant. I don't even remember what we talked about.
We talked about the disjointed plot lines. So it's still relevant. It's just very, very late. So I got into this weird, like, funk in my head and didn't feel like doing anything for a couple of weeks, and it just kind of kept going on. And I knew what I wanted to do with the podcast, but I didn't want to go through the editing thing because I was just sort of, like, zonked out for some reason. And now I'm finally back, come back up again and ready to finish it. Work has been bad.
Oh, Richard, I'm sorry.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's fine. It's whatever.
You know what you should do?
Are you going to suggest me to move to where you're at?
And come work for the University of Wisconsin Police Department.
There we go. I hear it pays well.
It does. It pays better than Virginia, which is dog shit at paying their police officers. So,
is the standard of living as bad as Northern Virginia? Or is it bad?
Well, standard of living is good in Northern Virginia. Standard of living is good.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant the cost of living. You're right.
No, I would say it is less than Northern Virginia, but more than Hampton Roads.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Good. That's fine. Well, it
depends also on where you live. Like, if you live in Dane County, the filthy liberals are driving up the property values. So, you know,
goddamn like liberals.
More. Yeah. So, but if you decide that you are okay living in podunk northern redneck nowhere and commuting 40 minutes to work every day, then you can get properties for a steal.
I grew up in podunk nowhere, Virginia.
I don't think Noakesville counts.
Yeah, anymore. I don't really think that counts.
I don't know. It took me a while to get to the movie theaters.
Prince William County has high property taxes.
This is true. Goddamn liberal.
All I know is, I don't mean to play this card, but
you will.
I was in the same boat that, like, it felt like Noakesville was kind of in the middle of nowhere compared to the rest of Northern Virginia. But then once you move to areas that are actually in the middle of nowhere,
yeah,
you realize that, like, it's just not the case at all.
Oh, yeah. Noakesville is 10 minutes
from a Target. It is not in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, my parents are in the middle of nowhere. Google Maps does not want to acknowledge that it's an actual address, so I have to use the latitude and longitude that I pick up from my GPS on the Garmin just to find where they're at. That's the middle of nowhere. So no Pokestops.
Come work UW football games where the pay rate is $53 an hour.
Whoa.
Yep.
Holy crap.
That's the pay rate for working a UW football game. Athletics pays it.
Oh, man.
Really?
Yep. And they have officers from all over Dane County to come. And if I'm working that and it's overtime for me, I get that at an overtime rate.
Wow.
Time to live that bougie lifestyle, Ian.
Of like $75 an hour or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, man.
So I'd imagine that it's because it gets crazy enough that
they
don't
really
want to do it.
They 1,000% need it staffed. So, like, otherwise the stadium, like, there's enough people in that stadium to, if they wanted to overrun the city. So, like, literally, the population of Madison is somewhere in the neighborhood of 250,000 people, and the population of that stadium on game day is over 70,000. So, if they decided that they wanted to, they could march up State Street and, like, burn the Capitol to the ground. Oof. So that's why the pay rate for the football games is $53 an hour.
Yep.
Yeah, and I never asked you this, but You used to be comfortable in this very bougie lifestyle, and I wanted to know what you guys are doing about your gym situation.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're at a sort of normal gym now. Like, it's
not an $800 gym?
No, it's $80 for the two of us per month. But it has, like, all of the same equipment as the gym we used to go to.
But doesn't have the coaches that Susan likes to get guidance from.
So I come up with workouts for both of us.
Right.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, good bonding, I guess.
Are they workouts that involve you having a baby in a few months?
No, those are extracurricular workouts. It's not going to be in a few
months.
It's
cardio day.
You know, they say that champions are made when no one's looking.
Speaking of
cardio, it's not that practice makes perfect, Ian. It's perfect practice makes perfect.
Speaking of cardio day, I went for a 7-mile run today. Richard, be proud of me.
I am very proud of you. My heel is possibly injured. I might have plantar fasciitis, so I have to not be running.
I did not know that you were Albert Pujols.
Well, I went to the doctor today. They found out. They think it's hopefully just inflammation, but they gave me that whole, like, come back in 2 weeks if it's not, if it's still not feeling well. Roll a frozen water bottle.
You are so helpful.
Yeah. They gave me some better pain meds, but that's about it.
Gotcha. Well, I felt pretty good about 7 miles until I remembered that it's almost 4 times as long to run a marathon. So I was like, ugh.
Oh, don't think about it. Baby steps.
Yeah. But I'm like, it's okay. It's 15 weeks away. I'm sure it'll probably be fine.
Oh, God. It's only 15 weeks away?
Shut up.
All right. Change the baby steps. Teenage steps. Teenage steps.
I know. I have a plan. I'm on the, I am on the plan. It's okay.
You never sent me the plan. I can't validate or I can't approve of this plan.
You can't approve of a plan you've never seen. What is it? I'll just read you the long run distances. Let's see. Because that's really the only thing that matters.
All right. We're missing the plan. I'm going to make you a new plan. All right.
Oh, there it is. So it was
20 miles on Saturday. Get it done.
So this week was 7 miles. Next week is 8 miles, then 9, then 11, then down to 8 for like recovery, then 12, then 13, then down to 6 for like deload, then 15, 17, 16, 20, 22, and then 2 weeks of deload at 16 and 8.
All right. I think 16, 17, 20, 22 is going to be the worst.
Yeah, it's super duper is. Like, it's a bit aggressive.
Well, I wish you the best of luck on that one, Ian. But that sounds about right. I mean, it's. I think you're, you know, getting down to the wire there and really cutting it close. But, like, you should be fine?
Thanks.
But seriously, bring those gel things. When you're on the run, like, those little, like, weird gel... I forget what the hell they're called, but like they're little like packets of like stuff you can like, suck on or whatever.
Yeah, I used them when I did my half, mm-hmm. and I really liked them.
Yeah, because so, save them for about like mile 15-ish, and then take one or two of them, and then hopefully that gives you whatever you need to kind of push through the rest of the marathon.
So, do we want to get to our actual content?
Oh my god, yeah, Patrick, tell us about 10-cent beer night.
All right, so. I'm going to have to set the stage with a little narrative. This is a story that I heard for the very first time about a week ago, and I thought it was so great that I needed to share it with you guys. But in order to set the stage for it, I got to talk about forfeits in Major League Baseball, because a lot of people, well, I don't know if you guys do, but forfeits are
part
of the
is that the sequel to Fortnite? Forfeit?
No.
Wow. Dad joke.
Ba-doom. No, that's just awful.
I'm pretty sure it's called Forfeit. My grandson plays that.
Okay, I just thought of something. Just remind me after you're done, Pat. Anyway, go.
Forfeits in Major League Baseball used to be a really big deal. Like, they happened all the time because a lot of stadiums didn't have lights. Some cities had curfews, whatever. Since 1970, though, forfeits extremely rarely happen. And they've actually only happened 5 times since 1970. The final one that I'm going to describe is 10-cent beer night, which is going to be the main topic. But I just want to go through real quickly what the 5 forfeits since 1970 are. The most recent one was in 1995 when the LA Dodgers had an excellent idea that they were going to have a giveaway promotion of baseballs for all fans entering the stadium. So
I think I've heard of this one.
In the 7th inning, there was a call that the fans disagreed with.
Oh, God.
To Raul Mondesi. Do you remember that name, Ian? And Raul Mondesi argued the balls and strikes, and he was ejected by the home plate umpire. Well, the fans didn't like that, and they threw all of the baseballs onto the field at the players.
Oh, my God. What did the players do?
And so the game was called, and it ended in a forfeit by the Dodgers. And also Major League Baseball banned, there is a rule in the rule book of banning baseballs as giveaways or any other throwable option.
You can give them away. You should be smart. Give them at the end of the game.
Yeah. So I guess the Dodgers did it a few years later and they gave them at the end.
Much better.
There was another one about disco music in 1979.
Oh, I heard about this one. Oh, yeah. That was back when they were hating disco, those bastards.
Yeah, something like I really don't care about that one.
Whoa! You can't skip over that if you're gonna like just say I don't care. They basically encourage people to bring their disco records in, and they're gonna do like a disco burn and smash thing. And surprise, surprise, that got out of hand.
Yep. So the third one was back in 1977, and Earl Weaver, who was probably one of the most fiery managers of all time. I don't know if you've seen Earl Weaver videos.
Yeah, I have.
He was in. He was a manager for the Orioles.
He's related to you.
No,
me too.
He was a manager for the Orioles, and they were in Toronto at the time, and he was really upset about the tarps that were put over the mounds in the Blue Jays bullpen. And just for reference, this was back in the day where the bullpen mounds is very common for them to be in foul territory.
Mm-hmm.
So he got really upset about it because he was worried that one of his outfielders was going to trip if he stepped on the tarp. And he wanted them to be removed, and the umpires told him to go fuck himself. And then Earl Weaver's like, fine, I'm just not going to play this game. And that was the forfeit.
What?
The second best one, short of the 10-cent beer night, is the last game played by the Washington Senators at RFK. The Senators are going to move to Texas to become the Texas Rangers back in 1971. And Senators were up 7-5 against the Yankees at the time. And the fans were really upset that they were moving from Washington to Dallas. And they did not realize that there were only two outs in the bottom of the ninth. And they decided to storm the field and vandalizing the entire stadium as they went, like ripping out
a tradition that's still maintained in Washington today.
Yep. And the best part about it is that
just not with baseball,
the reason
with
why
city.
Like they had to forfeit the game and why order was essentially never restored is because all of the staff from RFK left early, including the security guards.
Oh my
so
god.
So there was like nobody there to stop them.
It's lawlessness.
Right. So, all right. So that brings us to 10-cent beer night. So
back it's a very cheap amount of money to buy a beer, Pat.
Yes. And even in 1974, which is when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Let's set the stage. So it's the Indians versus the Rangers. And the game that they had played prior in Texas, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but there was a hard slide into second and somebody throwing behind somebody in a benches clearing brawl. And the Rangers were interviewed after the game and were asked about going to Cleveland in the next week or two. And there were quotes like, oh, we're going to have to bring our battle armor or something like that. They were expecting retaliation from the Indians. Well, so the Indians, in their infinite wisdom, decide that they're going to host a 10-cent beer night promotion that night that the Rangers came back. And Ian's going to really appreciate this. So the limits on the 10-cent beer night was that they were 10 cents, obviously. You could only order 6 at a time.
Oh my god, that's not a limit.
But you could purchase as many times as you want.
No! So
you could go and you could get 6 and then you could get up and you could get 6 more or whatever.
How do you carry 6? Do they have like a tray for you?
I guess.
You just have your son carry the rest.
Yeah.
So, and they were 12 fluid ounce cups.
Of course they were.
3.2%
beer. Jesus, not even 8 ounces. 12.
It's got to be like the horse piss of horse piss beer to be able to afford this.
There's alcohol.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying, though.
And this was 6 days after the big brawl in Texas, all right? The stadium was packed. It had over 25,000 fans.
People probably showed up who didn't even care about baseball. They were there for the beer.
Exactly. And like they said that according to their normal, like their expected attendance at a normal game, it was over twice the number of fans that were
That's what the Rays need to do. We need to bring back 10-cent beer night and we'll fill the trough.
Right. Anyway, so the fans got really inebriated really quickly. Apparently early in the game, one of the Cleveland players hit a line drive off of the Texas pitcher's stomach, and the entire stadium cheered and started chanting, "Hit him again, harder, harder." There was a bunch of naked people who sprinted onto the field and whatever. So anyway, there was a argued call at first base, and like somebody supposedly spiked somebody else, and everybody got mad. They started throwing things under the field. Well, that was like when the problem started, I guess. But from there, the Indians ended up tying the game in the ninth. So like it's like 5-5 in the ninth. And a fan jumps over the fence, runs into center field, and snatches one of the Texas's outfielder's hats off of his head. And when the outfielder's name was Jeff Burrows. And when Burrows turned around to like be like, what the fuck are you doing? He accidentally tripped, right?
Ooh, Burrows or the guy?
Burrows. Okay. And so, however, because this is in the 70s, the Texas's manager, Billy Martin, thought that the fan had attacked Burrows, not that Burrows had just tripped and fell.
Yeah.
So all of the Texas players and Billy Martin ran onto the field wielding bats and stuff to like go after the fan.
Oh, God.
And so seeing this, an extremely large number of fans jumped over the fence with knives, chains.
Holy shit, knives? Chains? Seats. Who brings chains? Who carries chains around with them? I need to know this.
Yep. All right. Well, so I mean, it's the 70s. And
this right here, this is why we get paid $53 an hour to work UW football games.
This is that episode of right. Brockmire. Not since Pearl Harbor have I seen such unprovoked right. acts of aggression.
And portions of the stadium seats that they ripped from the
holy shit.
Okay. And so, okay. And so if you didn't think this gets better, so obviously they surged onto the field, and obviously the hundreds of fans who are doing this outnumber the like 30 Rangers players. Well, realizing that the Rangers' lives might be in danger, Cleveland's manager at the time, what's his name? Ken Aspromonte. He then ordered all of his players, the Cleveland players, to grab bats and to help the Rangers.
Oh, God.
And they ended up attacking the team's own fans in the process. And so...
This is Thunderdome! Riders
began throwing steel folding chairs.
Tell me there's footage of this.
I actually don't know.
There
has to be footage somewhere. This is amazing. This is the best thing I've ever heard.
All right, so I'm going to I'm just going to read it verbatim from here. So Riders began throwing steel folding chairs, and Cleveland relief pitcher Tom Hilgendorf was hit in the head by one of them. Hargrove, after subduing one Rider in a fist fight, had to fight another on his way back to the Texas dugout. The two teams retreated off the field through the dugouts in groups with players protecting each other. The bases were pulled up and stolen, and many rioters threw a vast array of objects, including cups, rocks, bottles, batteries from radios, hot dogs, popcorn containers, and folding chairs. As a result, the umpire, crew chief, blah, 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 realizing that order would not be restored in a timely fashion, forfeited the game to Texas. He, too, was a victim of the rioters as one struck and cut his head with part of a stadium seat.
Holy shit. Jeez. Yes, there is footage on YouTube. The first thing I found is 10 Cent Beer Night 40 years later, and I can see all like the terrible hairdos of the 70s as these fans are on the
link
field.
Link it to Telegram. We'll watch it later.
All right, we'll do.
There you go.
Amazing.
So, if you're ever thinking to yourself that your job really stinks, that you are really bad at marketing or promotion.
That guy just got remember. So fired. Oh, my God. That guy got so fired.
Jesus. Oh, well said, Pat. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you went in for the podcast.
I know it was a little bit of a long-winded setup, but it was definitely worth it to get to one of the last forfeits in Major League Baseball history, 10-cent beer night in Cleveland, Ohio.
Nice. Ian, what did we want to remind you?
Oh, just about it's kind of not as funny because of Patrick's thing. So well,
now we're curious. So.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Let's just
what the hell?
Yeah, what the hell? I wrote it in the show notes to make sure I remember. Oh, remind Pat, Ian Pat after reminded, Pat.
Pat reminded me something he said. Reminded me of dad jokes and me and my the president of my academy class that I just graduated from. We had a tradition that in the morning we would each tell each other a dad joke. And it was like the funniest, like the most cringy, awesome tradition ever, because the director of the academy would come. He greeted us every morning before class started. And so, like, it got to be where I'd be like, hey, Dr. Zimney. And he'd just, like, look down, like, regret his choices, sigh, and he'd look at me, all right, Ian, hit me. And I'd tell it to him, and he would almost never laugh.
Almost never. Did you ever get him to laugh?
I got him to laugh at one, where I will repeat it to you now. And then I will also repeat to you the other one that I got him to laugh at, but he laughed begrudgingly because it was extremely inappropriate. So I'll start with the less inappropriate one. So, like, why? Well, not less. It's fine. So, why do chicken coops only have two doors?
Why, Ian?
Because if they had four, they'd be chicken sedans.
Yeah. Oh my God, that is a bad joke.
I could see where that one's going. Yeah.
Yep.
And then the other one.
Wait, he laughed at that one?
He did chuckle. He let out a chuckle at that one.
Oh man.
Then the other one, let me phrase it right. I prefaced it by telling him, like, this is extremely not okay. He's like, it's fine. Okay, so why was Jesus always in such good shape?
Oh God. Oh God. I have ideas already, and I don't want to say God. Them. Why, Ian?
CrossFit.
Oh my God. I knew it was going to be something with the cross.
That's a good
one. I knew it was going to be something with the cross.
So, anyway, the long and the short of it was that the president...
I'm going to tell my mom that joke.
The president of our academy class worked a dad joke into his speech at our graduation, and it was awesome.
Well done, Ian. I'm glad we waited for that.
Okay, anyway, continuing.
All right, guys, this is to get into the real meat of this episode. It's the episode of hype and kind of looking back on some of the big hypes for the last month. So I'm going to start with the one. Since we just did a bunch of baseball stuff, why not continue? Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was called up 6 weeks ago when we should have done a second podcast, but whatever. Started off kind of terrible, but it's starting to look like he's turning around. I wanted your guys' opinions on whether or not he is living up to the hype yet or on his way or what have you.
Yeah, he's great. He's going to be great. He is great. I tried to get one of the guy in our league who owns him. It's Spencer. And I thought he might just be stupid enough to trade him away because he was terrible.
He never got back to you, did he?
No, he did. Oh. He turned me down. I offered him, let me see. It was a pretty, like,
tuna sandwich, huh?
Aggressively okay deal. I offered him, I offered him Rafael Devers and Michael Chavis for Vladimir.
Oh.
What the hell?
And he his response was, nah, I'll hang on to Vlad. I like the kid.
To be fair,
Devers and Chavis have both been very good, but
Guerrero Devers can suck a dick, though.
I might keep him forever if I had Guerrero.
Yeah. Pat, what do you think?
I think, in a more serious note, I think it's a little too early to tell.
Yeah. He's been up for about a month now, give or take a couple days. But that's about it.
The problem with the young guys is that it's really hard to judge whether he's just growing into his position and learning or whether he's just not all that good. And you guys are probably going to hate me for saying this. There's two examples that come up in my mind, and both of them are nationals. You remember when Bryce Harper first came up? I'm not saying that he was awful, but he really wasn't like an MVP when he was like 18.
No. Him and Trout both were like
Well, but Trout, so Trout's a little different, though.
Trout was horrendously awful when he first came
up. He was horrendous, then he went down, and then he came back, and
he was God, yeah.
The second example, though, is happening right now, is actually Juan Soto. So,
Juan
Soto had
a
great year last year, and he's what, like 18? I mean, he's not that old.
He's not 18, but he's...
But, no, like, I think he was 18 last year. Like, I do.
I don't know. He's starting to heat up, though.
I mean, he's batting .250.
Yeah, but look at his last week. Like, he's been on a six-game hitting streak. He's had three of those six are multi-hit games. Like, he's doing really well.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I'm just saying that, like,
he's
that...
He's hitting, like, 1,000. No.
Last year when he came up and all the hype and everything, you thought he was going to be the next Mike Trout.
Yeah, but everyone, like, sophomore slump and stuff. Like, I mean, not everyone's, no one's like Mike Trout.
Mike Trout is. Do you know who is like Mike Trout?
Oh my god.
Who is like Mike Trout?
Yes.
Is this working into the next part, the Gleyber Torres?
No. Gleyber Torres is nowhere close to being Mike Trout.
He is to the Orioles.
Adalberto Mondesi.
Oh my god, here we go.
Oh my god, yeah.
Okay.
You compared him to Paul Goldschmidt last time.
No, I didn't.
He compared him to Cody Bellinger and said that he was better than Bellinger until
he is better than Bellinger.
He is not better than Bellinger.
Okay, he's got 17 stolen bases. He's like the number one player on the player radar right now or something.
And Cody Bellinger is hitting over 400, so...
Okay, he's number four on the player radar. But Bellinger is number one.
He's only hitting .394 with 43 runs, right. 17 homers, 44 RBIs, and 7 steals.
I'm aware that Bellinger is on steroids.
So you're telling me right now that if I offered you Cody Bellinger for Adalberto Mondesi, you would not accept?
I would turn it down, yeah.
Wow, you're fucking dumb.
It's principle. So you can't fight principle. Sustain that?
Yes. You think he's going to sustain that?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Well, really? So you think he's going to hit like 90 home runs and hit 400 this year?
I think that the final line for Cody Bellinger will be something around 330 with 40 homers and over 100 RBIs and runs. And I think he'll steal 18 bases.
I would like to be in the world that Ian's living in where 395 is sustaining to 330.
If Cody Bellinger hits 330, he could win the batting title.
I don't doubt that.
So
I'm just saying dropping 65 points is not sustaining.
So you're saying that Cody Bellinger winning the batting title would be a disappointment?
Yes.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
Because Mondesi is going to hit 20 home runs this year, easy, and he's going to steal like 50,000 bases.
50,000? That's a lot of bases.
Yeah. Can I put you down for that? Put that on the board? 50,000?
Well, let's put on the board. I have the under on 50,000 bases.
You can't make the under on 50,000 bases!
So wait, you're saying 100% that Mondesi is going to hit 20 home runs. He's only got 5 so far.
Yeah, well, the season's only a quarter over.
I mean, can I just say that you're bragging that he's going to hit 21 home runs, and Bellinger's almost at 21 home runs right now. So
the home run total for the stolen bases.
Mondesi is a poor man's. He's a poor man's 5 year younger Jose Altuve.
Whoa.
No way. He's a poor man's Mike Trout.
No, that's not the Trout. First of all, Trout is more a power hitter than a stolen base guy anyway.
He wasn't at the beginning of his career.
He profiles much more like Altuve than he does. He's kind of like? He's kind of like if Starling Marte stole more bases.
He's kind of like if Starling Marte was any good.
Savage.
So, like, I don't know why, in our league anyway, Mondesi has continued to be so, I don't know if under the radar is the correct word, but like forgotten. Because like the second half of the year, he was the best player in baseball, and I could not get anybody to even talk about him.
I mean, I think that in our league, the stolen base guys are undervalued because we have an extra batting category that has nothing to do with steals. Like, I think that if we were only 5 batting categories, like without the OPS, it would inflate the stolen base value a little more. So, but now instead of it being 1 out of 10 categories, it's 1 out of 12. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I mean, I think
that's probably it more than anything else. Really.
It's just like, he's not good. Definitely is playing amazing this year. He's living up to the hype.
He's the
premier. That's the reason why Pat, like, everyone's like, yeah, we knew he was good and now he's good.
Moving on. Last year, everybody said that he sucked donkey dick. And
nobody said he sucked donkey dick.
Yes,
we said
did.
You suck donkey dick.
Oh, baby. Don't get me started on that donkey dick.
Ugh. Turn.
Can we agree to disagree that, yes, Cody Bellinger may break records this year, but not Ted Williams' record, and that he probably will have a better year than Adalberto Mondesi? But Mondesi is still going to finish as a top 5 player.
What if he does break Ted Williams' record? What would you do?
He won't.
Red Cody Sox Bellinger fan? Is not going to hit 400. It's not going to happen.
I'm just saying, what if it did?
If it did, then he would be the number one player in fantasy.
Fair.
not only would he be the number one player in fantasy, like Mike Trout would essentially lose his window.
Mike Trout,
all the bullshit about how Trout needs to market baseball better, it would then become the Cody Bellinger show. Like, he would be selling hitting DVDs and stuff.
Like, you can see, honest, you can see the MLB titles for like the articles already, like Saved by the Bellinger, MLB yep. Saved for the.
It's pretty insane that Bellinger's batting average is still this high this late in the season.
Yes, yep. It is.
It is. So you know what else is impressive?
I don't know what HGH he's taking, but he needs to keep taking it.
Yeah. Mondesi has 17 stolen bases already.
Okay, Jesus. Anyway, Vlad is. So, yeah, if you held on to Vlad Guerrero, you did a good job. He's especially in a keeper, mostly in a keeper league. Like, I really hoped that Spencer was going to be dumb enough to trade him to me, but here we are. So
he's not that dumb. Not yet.
Well, he's not situationally that dumb.
Oh yeah, you just gotta wait for the right opportunity when his team is in really terrible situation and he desperately needs something to help him, and Vlad isn't doing great for some reason at that particular time. That's when you strike.
More likely that he's going to be the guy who dumps his team because he's not coming back next year.
Yeah. And before we transition off of baseball, this is my reminder that Joey Gallo has 15 home runs and that he's batting 293.
Yeah, can't believe it's still 293. That's insane to me.
All right, yeah, Ian. Okay.
Gleyber Torres.
Real talk. Who is going to have a higher batting average?
Oh, here we go. I see where this is going.
By, let's say, the All-Star break.
Ooh.
Okay. Joey Gallo or Gleyber Torres?
Oh, interesting.
See, you thought I was going to go Mondesi, but it's an easy answer with Mondesi.
Yeah, because if you had said Mondesi, I would have said absolutely Mondesi. But Gleyber Torres, I don't believe in Gleyber Torres at all. But if he has, I don't know, how many more times does he play the Orioles before the All-Star break?
You know they rested him today?
Did they really?
They rested him and he pinch hit and they intentionally walked him and he came around to score.
Jesus.
Oh my God.
I'm going to say Torres, but I don't feel great about it because I really don't particularly don't buy really to what Torres is doing, but I will say Torres. I think that the smart play is to say Torres.
Okay. You disagree, Richard?
No, I actually like Torres more than Ian does, so I think it's Torres.
Okay. So even though he's, I guess he's now hitting over 300, but I don't know about that.
It's funny because he's hitting only like 250 against the rest of the field.
Yeah, his slash line is like below the Mendoza line if he's not playing against the Orioles.
I think it's weird for sure, but I think that, like, I believe in the talent, so I think it's weird that he's under the Mendoza line, like you said, against the other teams, but I don't think it's going to stay that way.
Yeah, I mean, he's
not that bad.
He doesn't walk much. He's like, I don't know. I haven't liked him as much as Pat has over the course of the entire time in the league, but it's...
So this has kind of been my downfall this year, kind of, is that even though I'm having a great year, I'm happy with my team, is that I was really focusing on the center infield and wanting to get as much value as possible out of the center. And in that case, kind of sacrificing some of the more traditional power areas.
That is a bull-faced lie. You have like a million first basemen.
Well, yeah, but not most of them are not very good.
Sure, sure.
Like, Abreu's been kind of lackluster so far. Goldschmidt started off really hot and then hasn't done jack shit in like a month.
He's been fine. I mean, he hasn't hit many home runs since that first month, but he's gotten his average. I will say, though,
I'm glad that you mentioned first baseman, because my draft day prediction really does make me feel like I'm the three-eyed raven, because I, if you remember, we were arguing about Miguel Cabrera. Somebody was.
Ian was. He hates Miguel Cabrera.
And how he was washed up. And I said, all of these guys on my team that can hit home runs, all he has to do is hit 300 and just sit there. And it doesn't matter if he does anything else. Well, I tell you what, good sir. He is hitting 300.
292.
And he's literally doing nothing else.
Yeah.
He is literally doing nothing else.
He's got one home run.
One homer. Jesus. Yep.
And it's not like he's really been hurt. Like, he's hurt for a little bit, but not really. He just hitting the home run, just slapping those singles. It's really, you know, his, he's not getting many you know extra base hits at all.
Percentages right now?
Huh?
You guess what his slugging percentage is right
now?
Yeah,
it's 357. I'm looking at it.
Yeah, it's fucking garbage.
His average is 292 for the year, and his slugging is 357.
Yeah.
Like, man.
There's no power.
If anything, it shows how good of a hitter he is, because it's almost like he's going up there and just being like, I'm ready to retire.
He suddenly turned into late career Ichiro. He's just a slap hitter now.
Yep. Well, speaking of Three-Eyed Raven, you guys ready to move on to the next? Or do you want to keep talking?
Man. Oh, man. The most controversial of topics.
Yeah. Ian, season 8 of Game of Thrones ended. Ian, what was your opinion on how it all ended? I guess start with that question.
Wow, that's
shouldn't
like
you
a
do
really
a disclaimer about how you're talking
spoilers,
about spoilers?
Oh, man, you're right. Holy crap.
Skip to the timestamp in the description below.
Yeah, so with that being said, you've been warned. If you haven't watched it yet, either you... I don't know what happened, but yeah, you've been warned. All right, Ian.
How do you want to attack this? Like, do you want to attack it as like a whole season, or do you want to talk about the last episode first, or what do you want to... Like, because this is kind of a broad topic.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so I guess let's just talk the last episode and then kind of work into what we thought of the whole season. So, like, how did you think of the last episode as, like, a cap to the end of the season?
I would say it was good.
Okay.
Well, I mean, like, all right, so, like, broadly speaking, I think it was good. There were some really... powerful. I want to start by just saying that I have nothing but praise for the actors, both in this episode and the rest of the season. I thought that many of them gave Emmy-worthy performances. If you ever go back and watch some of the early episodes, like a lot of them have really like amped up their performance, particularly like Emilia Clarke.
Yes.
She started out as like kind of okay, and then she really got much better as the series went along. Anywho, I would say it's okay. I was pleased with the ending in the sense that it made sense, that there wasn't anything like totally out of left field where I was like, that makes no goddamn sense. Why would that happen? I felt it made sense. It provided satisfactory endings to a lot of the character arcs that also made sense for their character progression, which I think is important.
Yes.
I felt that It was not an ending that felt that it needed to say exactly how each character ended up years from now or would end up years from now. Like some endings really feel the need to do, which I always thought was kind of took away a little bit of the magic of like being slightly ambiguous, which I think is kind of good in an ending. So I really liked how they brought it back down to the Stark family, just how it started.
Right.
And then I felt like some of the directorial choices were spot on, like how the last scene mirrored the first scene from the series with John riding north of the wall, whereas it mirrored the Rangers riding north of the wall in the first scene of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
I thought that was really powerful imagery. What else? So, like, of course, you had Drogon melting the Iron Throne, which is just probably one of the best.
Best emotional performance. I think Drogon wins an Emmy for his performance at being sad and angered at the same time.
It was probably one of the better scenes in the entire series. Like, I thought that was really great. The scene where Daenerys is walking out like to address the troops and Drogon's wings behind her. Like, some really great cinematography.
That's going
to
be a background for a lot of people's computers throughout the years. Yeah.
It's so like, and throughout the season, you know, one of the things that they definitely hit right on, like they really know how to frame their shots. They really know how to do visual storytelling well. In a way, it reminded me a little bit of J.J. Abrams in that their visuals are really strong.
It reminded me of Breaking Bad, too, where Breaking Bad, I thought, like, I may not have liked a lot of the plot of the story because I'm just not that into those kind of subjects. But I had to admit, like, the camera work, the way they did their shots, the way they framed their scenes and everything, it was really top notch, and you see it again in their sister show, Better Call Saul.
Yeah,
and I felt the same thing with Game of Thrones, where I'm like, these are really good choices that they've made in terms of like pulling me into this scene.
Yeah, so like, and I want to give you like, I'm kind of talking a lot, so I want to give you time to respond to everything I'm saying. Things I didn't like, it did feel rushed. Like I've been trying to like approach the worst thing about stuff like this and other shows that become like events are that everyone has to fucking spout their fucking opinion on the internet. And people, and like no one can just like view it in a vacuum, decide whether or not they like it, and then like have that be their opinion. Like everyone has to see what everyone else thinks of it. All I feel like it's been more so for this than a lot of shows recently. Everyone just suddenly, it became the thing to say like, well, the writing just never was as good. Like be specific, and they can't be specific because no one knows what the fuck they're talking about. Right. So critically speaking, it felt I think that the thing more less the writing, like everyone loves to say the writing doesn't make sense.
Well, it's something with the writing. Say, it's not the whole thing, but like there's something specific. Yeah.
I
have input on this subject.
So I would say, let me finish. Being specific more so than just the writing is the pacing for me was off. Not necessarily that like the dialogue was garbage or that things became contrived, which occasionally they did. I would say that more so than that is the show became more plot driven because of pacing choices, because they shifted gears. It was almost like these guys, they shifted gears towards more plot centric narrative choices where they wanted to have big cinematic payoffs to people's storylines, because I think that's what they thought that the audience wanted, because the audience said that that's what they wanted. But here's the thing is that people don't know what the fuck they want, because how many times, Richard, over like the 7-8 years before season 7, were people saying, God, when is Daenerys going to sail over and fucking burn down Westeros already? I'm tired of
the moment. The moment the dragons hatched and did a little poof of fire, people have been asking for her to do that.
For fucking 6 seasons, all people did was bitch about the Essos story with Daenerys. And they're like, I don't care about Essos. I don't care about Meereen. God, why doesn't she just get some ships and go kill everyone? Like, literally all anyone would fucking talk about for six seasons. And then what does she do? She goes over to Westeros and kills a bunch of people. And then people are like, the writing was never as good. Yeah. Like, fuck all of you. Okay.
You keep going. You keep going. I have
opinions on this subject.
I would just say that they tried to give the audience what I think they thought the audience wanted in season 7 and 8. The only thing that I thought was just terribly poorly written and conceived, I really did not like the concept of them going north to get a white to bring down a show to Cersei.
That whole segment, not just the white, but like them being rescued too. Everything about that was just terrible.
It was very cinematic, like plot armor.
Well, they didn't know what to do. They didn't know
how to get them out of that situation.
Yeah, so did they really have, like, the idea of getting them in that situation was also laughable. It was like horrendously stupid. Like a 3-year-old would have come up with that idea. And I'm like, you guys couldn't think of anything else of a smarter plan than this?
And that's the thing. And the thing that made it worse was that Tyrion came up with the idea.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't think Tyrion is this dumb. Like, this is an extremely stupid plan. And it didn't make a lot of sense, because like anything you do with Cersei is just going to, like, the smarter thing would have been like, we need to end the war before the White Walkers break through the wall, so that we can, like, that would have been actually more interesting if you had framed it that way, because then Daenerys has her excuse to burn King's Landing to the ground.
Yeah.
Because, and she's like, well, it's in service of the realm, because we need to go defend against the White Walkers. And then Jon has to make the moral choice about, well, you know, killing thousands of innocent people, blah, blah, blah. Like, it would have presented a moral paradigm. And if she falls to her Targaryen blood and does that, then you have like the looming specter over her as the Mad Queen, as you face against the White Walkers in the final battle. But like, anyway, I'm getting off track. I want to hear what you have to say, but I think that the problem became a pacing problem more so than a writing problem, because
I have opinions on this.
They shifted gears towards how their storytelling was, because it became more plot centered storytelling rather than character driven.
Yeah.
Pat, okay, those are my thoughts.
I agree with a lot of them. I got stuff written down. Pat, you've got thoughts though.
All right, so mine are short and sweet, because I've read all the books, the released books, and I've watched up to a certain season, like season 3 or something.
Oh, really? You didn't finish out the books
Oh no, I finish out the books.
No, I mean like you never. Sorry, you never finished the TV show up to where they left off in the books.
Yes, yes, I did exactly that. I don't know what season it was.
Six, somewhere around there.
I essentially watched the first episode or first couple episodes after the books ended.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is really fucking dumb, and I turned it off. So anyway, so that's kind of my thing. Okay. But the idea is, my opinions on it is that everybody, and it goes across fantasy, science fiction, everybody is trying to recreate what J.R.R. Tolkien does, but completely not understanding how that actually works from a narrative perspective, right? And you could see this with either the show or Martin's or the actual books itself, that this was going to end poorly no matter what they did. And the reason is, and what I'm getting at is that, like, Tolkien created a massive world through essentially through mystery. Whenever he would set a long winding stage, he would make little quips about things that have happened, you know, like little short stories, little half things. But he didn't do that by like introducing new characters or anything. It was like Mary talking to Pippin and be like, oh, hey, you remember the great riots of 1902 and, you know, whatever.
Right.
Okay. And it created just this massive world with so many untold stories. And but throughout the novels and, I mean, even the movie adaptations, like, you never got the feeling of loose ends, wrong directions, or anything like that. Unfortunately, many franchises, including Game of Thrones, has done it in the opposite way. Like, they've made a full world by actually making it full. And so you have a cast in both the books and in the show that's like 200 memorable characters in it and all their little storylines and going back and forth and everything like that. And it paints the writers in a corner once you are trying to wrap everything up,
yeah,
where it's literally impossible to do it correctly because it's either you're lambasting the world and essentially making fun of your viewers by making it too small, making people make really poor decisions that don't make any sense in the scope of the world, or like, I mean, a combination of the two, or just like leaving things just completely open and not giving any closure.
Well, would you say that that's because, like, the Lord of the Rings centrally had a very clearly defined enemy and goal, like, right, throughout the books? Like, so the enemy is Sauron, and the goal is to destroy the ring. That is, like, very narrow. But with Game, right, of Thrones, the enemy is everybody, and, right, the whole theme is that power corrupts everybody, and who, I guess, in the end, who's going to sit on the Iron Throne, but it doesn't really matter, because whoever it is just going to be corrupted anyway.
Right. So I think you're exactly right. So the point in Lord of the Rings is that it's actually a very narrow cast with a very narrow focus, but you never get that feeling throughout the entire experience.
Right.
Whereas Game of Thrones, the focus is so wide that while the main point might be the Iron Throne or the main point might be the White Walkers or whatever, like, there's always, because there are so many points, there's always going to be people who are more worried and focused on things that the writers just don't care about, and they will be disappointed. And so,
like, everyone had their favorite characters or favorite, right, storylines and stuff.
So you see what I mean? Like, yeah, you don't get this experience with Tolkien because Tolkien did it right, and everybody else is just trying to create the depth of Tolkien's work.
Well, that's interesting.
I don't know,
because
that's necessarily true.
Because, like, well, Tolkien came in from, like, and this is interesting that you bring up Tolkien and, like, how he did the stories, because I just saw the Tolkien movie, and they actually talked about that, about how, yeah, the idea was he liked making up languages, and
yeah, he made the languages first.
Yeah, and so the idea was he started talking about it, and he said the problem with languages is that you have, like, a word isn't just a word, you have to have meaning behind it, and that meaning comes from stories. People create, right, stories to, or have these words from these stories, ideas, and then you have the connotation for things. And so the girl, Edith, in the movie is like, well, if you look at the word hand, it's a very simple word, but, like, it's what we associate with hand. And then she just sort of brushes his arm with her hand, and it's just like, this is like a connotation. It's not, it's more than just the word or how it sounds or whatever. And so the idea is that Tolkien's stories were built out of these like language things that he came up with. And so when he fill his world up, it's with all these stories that have now created this history of his world because of the fact that, you know, that's how, you know, the world usually works is with these stories. With Martin, it's interesting because like his world is so wide, but like, the wide is only on these like noble houses, and it's only like you get like the north where you have like the common folk and the free folk and those who aren't nobility who matter and whatnot. But the more south you go, the more it's literally just the nobility that we talk about. Like soldiers, the average soldiers are no more than like an extra sword or a knife or an arrow that you could throw at the enemy or whack at the enemy. Like it just does not matter half the time with these guys. That like the whole world's when. The writers for the show had to start coming up with their own thing. Like, they no longer were bringing in, like, stuff that Martin had, which was, like, all these, like, in-depth things about all of his, like, filled world or whatever. They had to start making their own things, which either was a whole lot of work, or they just continued focusing on the stuff they already had, which was the nobility, and the world started getting really, like, shallow and empty as the seasons, season 7 and 8 went on.
I mean, yes and no. I don't know. I don't, it's hard for me to think that, like, that the show can be, like, construed as shallow just given the, I think it's
shallow because of its depth.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I think that's the thing, and I think that's, like, partially due to creative decisions made in the last two seasons. I'm still trying to decide if they thought that it was for the best because they wanted to have an upbeat pace for the last two, particularly the last season, where I thought that, you know, maybe they thought that if it was a 10 episode season or something that the pacing, like they would, you know, having that sort of like methodical slow burn that they typically did in Game of Thrones, that would somehow like detract from like the sort of breakneck pace of like, you know, super aha moments or whatever that they wanted to have. I don't know. I'm not in their heads. But like thematically, I think that the White Walkers were a problem, but not just for them. I'm interested to see how Martin deals with them. Like if he lives long enough to write his last book. So like for me, and I kind of thought about this before the season even started. The White Walkers have always sort of symbolized, in my opinion, this sort of nameless enemy that was almost going to be the reckoning for Westeros being just such a shithole. To me, I always envisioned it as, you know, this is a bunch of people fighting over the right to rule, most of them because of selfish reasons or some sort of entitlement. And that what they don't know is that there's this nameless enemy that doesn't give a shit about how highborn you are or who sits on the Iron Throne, because you're all going to die anyway. And for me, it was satisfying as a villain through the series. But at the end of the day, I thought the only way that this reaches a satisfying conclusion to the White Walker story is if most of these people die, and that didn't happen. And I don't know if Martin has like a better way to end it that isn't disjointed from how the main story ends. But it kind of felt like it was its own thing that ended kind of anticlimactically because they weren't sure how to tie it into like the main ending.
Yeah, so I think, well, here, do I want to segue nicely with the White Walkers or do I want to just give my opinion on the last episode? I'll just segue for now. So I think the White Walkers were kind of a wasted potential because like you said, the idea is that you have this enemy that doesn't give a shit about what status you are in society. It kind of compounds on the wasted stuff on Daenerys attacking King's Landing too, because like what would have been an interesting way to do it is if Jon and like the North are coming down and Jon just like strong arms everyone and that he just is like, listen, you all shut the fuck up, just give Cersei what she wants and we're going to attack these goddamn zombies, we'll worry about Cersei and everything afterwards, but like for the love of God, we cannot keep bickering. And then the fight with the Walkers would come, and that's when Cersei, because really the White Walkers were so cool because of the fact that Cersei had built up this power structure around herself and this like philosophy around her where like power is power sort of a thing. And people respected her and gave her power because of her stature and the way she wielded her stature. it would have been really cool to see her completely deflate to an enemy that gave no shits about that and just was going to keep coming. And, like, if anything, you doing that same sort of, like, oh, I'm going to, like, throw soldiers at all my problems, the enemy's going to be like, well, thanks for the extra troops. And it would have been kind of cool to have seen something, like, worked with that. But instead, the show kind of just, like, you know, compartmentalized the two. And it worked with one over here. And then it finally was like, okay, we'll deal with that second one over here. And well, they don't touch.
The thing. And I want to kind of, like, tie this back into Martin. Because it's very, it was pretty much said that George R. R. Martin talked with, you know, the two, you know, what they call, people call them D&D because it's easier. Like, that he talked to them about what his vision was basically for generally how it's supposed to end.
Right.
So, which makes me wonder if Martin really knows how he wants to wrap up the
Whitewalker
story.
That's what makes me wonder too. Yeah.
Because to me, they're more in, like, I think this kind of confirms it. Like, I thought the episode with the White Walker battle was very entertaining and it was very well directed.
Yes.
And like, I don't own a TV from 10 years ago, so I saw it but whatever, like some people, it's too dark.
Did people actually complain about that? Turn your lights off, increase the brightness or something. Like,
you read internet reviews way too seriously.
No, it's like,
it's not, these aren't reviews, these are people on comments just being little weirdos.
It's not even on the internet, like it was people in my class, like in my academy class, who were like, it was kind of dark. I'm like,
these are police officers.
These are the people who will be patrolling the night, keeping you safe.
I couldn't really see. Man. I'm like, that was the fucking point.
Yes.
But anyway.
Also like, that, yeah.
But anyway, like,
oh, when the fire lights all go out?
Yeah. So
not to derail, but it's like the Dunkirk disclaimers where like they would put the signs on front of the theater doors that are like, no, we cannot turn up the volume of the dialogue.
Down the bullet sounds or whatever.
Did you see those signs that they had to put up before Last Jedi about the scene where the lights where they light speed through the Star Destroyer and there was no sound?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was broken.
No, that's what space sounds like.
It's like, no, it was an artistic decision. Anyway. Yeah. Fuck, what was I saying? I think this kind of like shows that the White Walkers function better as like a looming threat than actually as like a true enemy, because they're kind of too easy and simple as like an actual face-to-face enemy, which it's not what Martin did throughout the whole story. The most interesting things throughout the whole fucking show and books are the power squabbles and the interaction between these characters, not just like trying to not having it turn into World War Z.
Well, yeah, but that's the interesting thing about the White Walkers is like, this is a world that George R. R. Martin has made a very like political structure gray area where a lot of people are kind of nipping and attacking each other, but like they're doing it in a way where you don't 100% know who the real bad guy is. I mean, you have like a Joffrey or Ramsay here or there, but like, even they're not like this huge power structure. Like, everyone already knows that they're going against them.
It's more ambiguous like, with some characters, yeah. like Stannis.
So then, here's this White Walker army that is like 100% true foil to all that. And they're just like, no, they are definitely the enemy. And while you guys all have differences, you might not like a couple of these people or whatever, these guys are 100% going to just steamroll over all of us and not like any of us. Like, it's not good. There's no negotiating with this. And I think that, like, again, it's just that missed opportunity where they really could have leaned into that foil and the juxtaposition between the two.
So it comes back to what I was saying. Like, wouldn't it have made thematically more sense for the White Walkers to just kill everyone?
Yeah, kind of.
And have the series end with, like, essentially no one sitting on the Iron Throne because everyone got wiped out.
Yeah, or, well, so it would have been interesting if they, like, if the series basically ends with, like, two or three people that we followed since the beginning or something, and they're just, like, sailing away because Westeros is just overrun.
Or, like, you have them win in the end or something, like, have a victory over the Night King, but, like, at a huge, huge cost.
Yeah, where like everyone's dead now, and
yeah, or something like that. Like, I just felt, and so I can't take the entire blame off of Martin, because I have to imagine that, like, if he had a pretty clear way that he wanted it to end that wasn't this, he would have said something.
Yeah, I think, I honestly think that Martin doesn't, he has like a general idea, and that's what he gave to them, and who knows what will actually be the final idea, because he hasn't written it. Soon. Yeah. Alright, here, I'm gonna give my take on this, like, episode, since I've been writing little jots down as you talked about things. You mentioned how, like, the actors were, like, stepping it up, and you think, and Emilia Clarke was probably one of the best examples. I have to agree at least on that, because, like, the thing I always compare, I've been comparing this last season to, is, like, the last season of How I Met Your Mother, because it was another disappointing season. But you could see it in the actors in How I Met Your Mother. Like, they all were, like, ready to check out. Like, it just felt like... Yeah,
they were pretty phoning it in. Like, particularly Neil Patrick Harris was pretty much phoning it in at that point.
Yeah, he was, and I would argue, actually, the guy who plays Marshall, I can't not remember the actor's name.
Siegel.
Jason Siegel. He was mailing it in so much that he wasn't even, like, in scenes anymore. He was just in a car ride that they just, they put him in a chair and had him, like, talk on a cell phone. That was, like, several episodes of him. That was his only, like, contribution to the show. But, like, at least in Game of Thrones, all the actors, I never felt like that. I never felt like they were, like, mailing in. It seemed like they were still 100% into the show. Even if the show was going in a direction we might disagree with, the actors themselves never seemed to, like, give you a hint that they weren't in on this. So I love that about the entire season and the one before. But and the last episode. But in terms of burning the city down, to go kind of back to that, I think that the biggest issue isn't that, like, it's not that it's contradictory that we wanted Daenerys to burn down the city and then all of a sudden get mad when she did. It's more of the timing of it all. So, like, every time we've said, like, I can't wait for Daenerys to get over there and burn the city, it's when, like, Cersei has been, like, queen bitch 110%, like, on the thing, and we're just like, well, fucking hell, this is the worst thing in the world. Like, when she blew up the Septon, when she, like, the nun, when she used the church the first time as a weapon against, who was it?
The Sparrows.
Yeah. Just all these things that, like, Cersei was sort of doing in the name of her own power, and, like, while, like, trotting on people. It just was, like, these moments where you're like, I really want Daenerys to go over there and just burn this city. Like, these, first off, Cersei's an asshole, and second off, everyone's an asshole for following her. When she does, and I think that, again, it's an interesting moment where they could have done a little bit more with it, but, like, Cersei brings in all these, like, refugees, and it's just using them as a shield, as a moral shield, because if she has to attack, she has to attack through these things, these innocents.
And Cersei didn't think that Daenerys would do it.
Right. And I think that two things was, one, I kind of upset that, like, suddenly Drogon got the most plot armor I've ever seen since Jon Snow in the Battle of the Bastards, and... Where an arrow, they were able to shoot his brother out of the sky, one shot him from a distance that was, like, insane, with weapons that no one should be fully trained with at this point, since they're brand new, state-of-the-art things or whatever, and then are able to shoot him as he's falling down, like, he's already dead, but they're able to stick him with more arrows somehow. Like, these are expert snipers.
2 points on that before you move on.
Okay.
One is, I have sort of thought that this is maybe a good interesting point, is both times that both other dragons died, they did not have riders.
Yeah.
And so, like, and they've heavily implied that, like, dragons were not as formidable until they had a Targaryen to ride them.
Interesting.
So, like, I think that it could be that, you know, inherently a dragon on its own, of course, is dangerous, but that a dragon with a rider is better. And they never explicitly lay it out, but I think that, like, also having Jon riding Rhaegal in the battle against the dead is kind of indicative of that point. Yeah. I think that somehow that means that, like, that's better. They never explicitly say it, but I think at this point it can kind of be taken to be fact.
I would be okay with that if, like, if it was more obviously, like, they don't need to explain it. They don't need to let me know that, like, they don't need to anime it up and tell me, like, straight to my face. But, like, it would be nice for them to have shown a difference of them, where it doesn't really look like the dragons are helpless. It just looks like these enemies have made the most impossible shots possible somehow, and then repeat it. And that's the part that annoys me. It's just sort of like, well, I guess it doesn't matter what they're doing. The enemy's going to apparently hit them because that's what they have to do in this scene. Did you have a second point on that?
Well, it must not have been very good because effort. Okay.
So Drogon ends up, like, evading all these arrows and, like, somehow manages to destroy all the ships. No problem at all. Even though, like, Daenerys basically was going to do that when Rhaegal... Am I pronouncing that right? Rhaegal?
Rhaegal.
Yeah. Despite the fact she was basically going to do that right after Rhaegal gets shot to pieces. If they had made it so, like, Daenerys has to admit to her limitations and say, like, hey, I can't go through the water, the seaside, I have to go through the land, and then she makes the choice of, like, well, we need to get in there. And then suddenly it's not so much about, like, her losing her shit. It's her making a bloodthirsty decision in a cold, logic manner. And I think that that would have been a very better way to sort of build up on Daenerys starting to go, like, down this, like, hey, once I go down this path, there's no turning back sort of a moment.
See, but I don't think that's consistent with her character. Because, like, if you really think about, like, when she displayed ruthlessness in the past, a lot of times it was punitive.
Well, yeah, but like, this could be punitive too. It's just that, well, like,
you just said, it was more like a logical,
yeah, yeah, but like
to justify the blood. Like when she crucified the masters, like she had Meereen. Meereen was one, but she felt that they needed to be punished. So, like, it was a it, like a lot of times.
Weren't they also trying to like assassinate her too?
But like, and then you've got other like times after that where, like, for example, when she's in the Pyramid of Meereen. And like, I'm going to go burn their cities and like, you know, and like, you know, return their cities to the dirt. I don't think those were her exact words. And then Tyrion was like, can I propose an alternate approach?
Yeah.
Daenerys has always made decisions that were punitive ones. And this I felt was exactly that, was that she had the battle was won and she was not satisfied.
I agree with you, and it exhausts me a little bit because there's still something about that that doesn't match up 100% with how she does it. And I think it's something about like how she just like showed very zero discretion. Like she'd always done these like aftermath things to people and you're like, that was a little far, but you didn't, like, she never went for, like, the common people, I think, was the thing. Maybe. I'm still trying to figure this out. But, like, that's the like, all of a sudden, she just, like, burns everything, and she doesn't even go and, for the...
There's an important discretion to make there, right? Because, because in Essos, every city that she went to where, like, she liberated it, she was viewed as, like, a god.
Right.
Right? Like, they loved her.
They picked her up and carried her. Remember that episode?
And when she came to Westeros and, like, when she was, you know, attacking King's Landing, like, all of these people were terrified of her. Like, all of these commoners. Like, they fled into the city away from her.
That was propaganda. Whereas
Meereen, yeah, but, like, that's the thing, right? Meereen took itself back. So, like, she was beloved. I think she was always resentful that the people of Westeros did not view her the same way as the people of Essos did.
Well, yeah, but, like, the thing about it is, like, it just seemed like in her anger, which I would have viewed as if you were to explain, like, oh, well, of course she's angry. Like, her friend just got her head cut off and, like, her dragon just got shot. That's fine if you're going to use that explanation, but then why does she just start, like, burning her nearest vicinity? Why doesn't she go straight for Cersei's tower or King's Land?
And that's why I think it runs deeper than just anger at Cersei, because I don't think it's just that, but
I think that's the reason why I talk about the empty world then, because we don't get any interaction between her and the common folks other than an awkward toast in the north.
I'm not even saying it's just that. I mean, like, for her, she got what she wanted, but she lost everything else. Like, it's a hollow victory. Like, Jorah was dead. Rhaegal is dead. Missandei is dead. She just executed Varys. She doesn't trust Tyrion. And the man that she loves, Jon, is, in her mind, betraying him. So, she now has won the Iron Throne.
She's still got her best friend, Drogon.
From a group of people that she believes resents her, where her allies are either dead or traitors. Like, I think in that moment she was angry at Westeros, that she even hated the fact that she came to Westeros and the fact that she needed this. Like, I think it's a lot of complicated feelings.
I want to agree really well
with how she portrayed it.
I think, well, yeah, I think that it was very well portrayed. I just think that my issue is that I never saw the build up toward that. I never saw, like, her feeling resentful to Westeros. I never got to see other people feeling resentful to her. I just saw people running into King's Landing because Cersei basically corralled them into it. Furthermore, we almost never get... We got so few shots of Cersei and her scheming in Season 8 that it just... Like, when the end comes, I'm sort of like... I felt a little dissatisfied because there was no build-up anymore of it. There was no, like... they almost tried to make Cersei paint into this good light, and I'm like, we all know Cersei's not good. She's not a nice person. But, like, we haven't checked in with her in a very long time. But now, yeah. I feel like it just is a random person getting killed now.
Well, it was a shame because, like, after the Sparrows were dealt with, she had no more enemies in King's Landing. And Cersei was always right. The most interesting when she had enemies in King's Landing to deal with. And she didn't anymore.
Yep. Agreed. Yeah.
But I have reached my hard stop point. So I
oh, jeez. I thought you said 10:30.
No, I said 10. I said 10.
I saw 10:30.
I'm gonna check the notes here. 10. It says 10 right there.
It says 10:30.
It does not say.
I see hard line stop 10:30. Oh nope, you're right.
Pretty positive 10. It's 10:30.
You're full of shit. Anyway, I have to go, but damn. I will listen to the end of your statement.
Well, we can't talk about.
Well, before Richard gets the end of the statement, I want a real answer to: is the reason why you have a hard stop at 10 is because your computer or whatever your setup is in the bedroom and Susan has to go to bed so she can wake up early to be unemployed tomorrow.
Not unemployed. She works for American Family.
God damn. Why don't you just follow along?
That is 100% correct.
Okay.
I gotta go. But all right. I'll talk to you guys later.
Ian, it has been fun. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you.
All right, Pat. Do you have anything else you want to talk about? Last time we had a talk, Pat, you were talking about watching old shows again. Have you watched any new old shows or revisiting old shows?
Do you remember what old show we were talking about last time?
Top Gear and okay. I think...
And House? Was that what we were talking about?
I think House is what you just started watching with Brooke.
So we're continuing to watch House. We're on like season 5 or something now. And I mean, it's good. Like, it gets a little repetitive.
That's what I've heard, yeah. And
honestly, I feel like it's more because we're binging it.
What season are you guys on?
Like somewhere in season 5 now.
Okay. I was going to say...
There's like 20 episodes a season. So
right.
I feel like if you watch it once a week, like it was released, then it wouldn't be as repetitive. But it does suffer from the idea that there are only so many weird diagnoses that there can be.
And also so true.
It just becomes repetitive. But anyway, so Brooke has started watching Cheers again.
I heard you talking to us last night the night before when we were playing Civ, that you guys were watching Cheers or asking us if we liked Cheers or anything.
Yeah, it's a good show. Like, I don't know. I don't think it ages that well because it gets pretty sexist pretty quick.
I think it's also just like there's something about the styling of it that was more entertaining during that time. That because I've tried to go on. I'm a big fan of Frasier, and so I'm like, oh, right. I want to see where this all began, kind of a thing. And I've heard, you know, crazy things about Cheers, like pastors and priests saying like, everyone go home so we can all catch Cheers tonight, the last episode or whatever. When I've watched the first. I think it's the first season and some of the second season. There's something about it that I'm like, this is fine, but it's just not as funny. It's just not as like amazing as I thought it was going to be because there's something about how it's framed that it just sort of falls a little flat for me. And maybe because it's old and other things have maybe done the same thing and I've seen the all to death at this point, but who knows? That was always my take on Cheers.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair.
It's interesting that you said, like, it's, like, House is starting to get repetitive. I found that, like, about season 4 or 5, a lot of shows start to, you start to really figure out the formula, and you're sort of like, all right, I see where this is going already, and it's usually around the season 4, because I remember the same thing in Smallville, I remember the same thing in show, but just insert any sitcom, honestly, and you start to realize, like, this is going the same way as I thought this was, and now I'm getting a little like I'm feeling the repetitiveness at this point. And depending on the show, you can continue on and do well with it, like say 30 Rock or Parks and Rec or something. And then there are other shows that you just sort of for me, like, drop Smallville or Arrow or something, and I'm just like, I'm good. I'm done. I've seen enough.
So I think the idea for me is that this kind of falls into the Game of Thrones thing, too, is that I feel like either shows that have really slow burns or shows that intentionally just don't have burns at all. Like, it's just like it's their shtick. Kind of like House, you know, where it's kind of a self-contained episode, but it kind of follows the same formula. And yeah, they have like season arc narratives, but they're always very minor.
Right.
I feel like all of those styles of shows, all the characters that I just described, they suffer from the idea that us as humans want things to be resolved. And so you just bring us up to such a height, and then you just have this moment, and it's different for everybody in each series, where you have this moment where you're like, this isn't going anywhere, is it? Like,
yep.
And then, I mean, if it's really bad, then like at that moment, then you might quit watching it. Or you just might be left feeling unsatisfied. But like, I just feel like I have this style of conversation with a lot of different series and franchises and whatever, where it's like they cast the net so wide and they really build it up so much. It's just like there's no way that you can resolve this in a satisfactory way.
Yeah, I remember thinking that in the show Fringe as well. Another one where they cast the net wide, and just the first season was so good. And oh, you know what? Maybe Walking Dead is another one I could think of too, where you just the build up was almost better than the conclusion, and there was no way that the conclusion could ever like they set it up for something they just couldn't achieve, and it's just or what's even worse, what Fringe does sometimes, and what Smallville was notorious of, was that like when a season ended, it like was still building up to something in the next season, and then the next season would resolve it within an episode, and you're like, where was this focus for the entire last season?
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I enjoy long story arcs. It's just that if you try, like I said, if you try to cast the net too wide during that long story arc, then you're going to have a bad time.
Agreed. I very much agreed. The last thing, since we're talking about TV shows, so I watched the show The Marvelous Miss Maisel on Amazon. I've seen Amazon like just spam the living shit out of this show on their website for Prime Video.
Okay. I might have seen. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of hard not to see it. If you've ever gone to Amazon Prime's video at least a couple of times, it's like the first thing that they'll throw in your face. And I've ignored it for a very long time because part of me was worried that it was a musical. Another part of me worried that it was like some weird feminist thing. I don't know. And so I finally pulled the trigger one day after saying, like, fine, all right, fucking fine. I paid for the time. I might as well see what this is about. It technically is still a feminist thing, but they don't beat you over the head with it, which is nice. It is actually extremely funny. It is not a musical. It's written by the same, or it's created, it's the same creator who did The Gilmore Girls, which is an interesting comp because it doesn't, I guess if you squinted, you could kind of see the resemblance. So there are certainly scenes that have that same, like, dialogue stance that Gilmore Girls was notorious for, where it was just obviously this is all scripted dialogue. That's a lot of episodes of Gilmore Girls felt like that because of how fast they talked to each other and replied. Marvelous Miss Maisel has some moments like that. But what's interesting is that instead of a very slice of life kind of subject matter of we're just watching Rory and Lorelai go through life, in Marvelous Miss Maisel, it's all about stand-up comedy in the 1950s. Hmm.
Oh, interesting.
Which was about when 1950s was about when stand-up comedy was actually being a thing. It wasn't, you had a lot more like skits and stuff for comedy. You didn't really have like this idea of you'd go into a restaurant or a club or something, sit down and listen to a stand-up. That it was just kind of, this is the infancy days of it. And so it's all surrounding this girl, Mrs. Maisel, Midge, who's known to her friends, who is starting as a stand-up comic. And what's even more different is, back then, the kind of comedy wasn't what we know today. It's like, the kind of comedy was like, they would make up a skit, they would do like slapstick humor, they would have like a weird story where they have like a phone conversation pretending to be Abe Lincoln kind of a thing. That was their version of comedy. Well, eventually we had this like Seinfeld era where it was more of like our comedy is known as observational humor is what everyone likes to hear more than anything, or peppered in with political satire or with like maybe something of your own story that you tie back into observational humor. With Marvelous Miss Maisel, that's her gimmick. That's her thing, is she does observational with political and her family kind of stuff peppered into it in a world where not many women are doing stand-up, and even the stand-up is everyone's got like a different like skit kind of a gimmick thing instead. So it's really funny. I really enjoyed it. And I'm surprised it took me this long, but maybe because of the fact that Amazon advertised it almost too much, it almost seemed like they were desperate. So it turned me off earlier. I'll use that as an excuse, but I recommend this show. It's only two seasons right now, but the third season is coming somewhere in the fall or winter, I think.
That's cool. I haven't really watched anything new, I don't think. Oh, I watched this documentary on Netflix the other day about the guy who memorized all the prices on The Price is Right.
Oh, really? Okay. Weird documentary choice. How was it?
Yeah, so it was called The Perfect Bid, I think. It's about this guy who, from a really young age, way back in the day, was obsessed with The Price is Right. And he would watch it all the time, and he noticed that many of the products that show up on the for bidding and stuff are like recycled products. Like they use the same product in multiple shows.
Oh. Okay.
And so he grew up, and I can't remember what he did for a living, but he did something that
department store salesman.
I don't know. Like he became like a something had to do with computers. And so he built a really basic, like programmed a really basic program and database where he could type in all of the products that he would see and their price. And so then he would use that like database and just memorize it over time.
Oh, wow.
And so from there, and it's like, it's kind of a complicated thing where like how you get selected to be on the show. Cause like anybody can go and stand in line and get a ticket to go in, but there's only like a slight chance that you're gonna get selected right. to like be a contestant. It's this like really long-winded story where he had gone like 34 times or something like that, and he finally got selected, and he ended up winning like his game. But when he did the spin, are you familiar with Price is Right?
Yes. And this sounds hilariously like what I guaranteed that How I Met Your Mother had a episode where Barney Stinson also guessed every exact number for Price is Right. And I have to imagine they're spoofing this is what.
Yeah. So they did the spin the wheel thing, you know, to see who goes to the final.
Mm-hmm.
And he spun really badly. And so he didn't get to go to the final. But
that sucks. No matter how much you prepare, it's the stupid random encounter thing right. that ruins it.
The thing about Price is Right is they let everybody in the audience like shout stuff out to people.
Yeah.
Like, and so he would just constantly go, and he would always shout out like the exact answer to like everything. So it all culminated after Bob Barker retired, because he started becoming kind of like famous to like Bob Barker and like a few of the producers and stuff.
Right.
And I guess he was referenced on a few of the shows. But anyway, Bob Barker retired, and they had like fired the original producer. And so then it was Drew Carey. Well, then in 2008, I think it was, there was this guy whose name I can't remember who was in line and was standing next to the subject of the documentary. And he was telling him about how he knew all the prices. And so he convinced this guy that if he got to be a contestant, then like just listen to him and he'll be fine. Well, he did. And he got all the way to the showcase showdown. And for like the first time in the history of the show, he guessed the showcase to the dollar.
Ooh.
Like all the prizes together, like to the dollar.
Yeah.
And like apparently it was like this big scandal and stuff, and like, and yeah, so it was a, I mean, if you want to waste, like, I think it was about an hour long, like yeah, if you want to waste an hour like with something fairly entertaining about The Price is Right, it's pretty good.
Yeah, that sounds interesting, especially considering that I'd be coming in from like watching, having just like having seen the How I Met Your Mother episode, I'd be like, okay, I remember the episode, let's see what they drew on from real life and what they made up or whatever, because I'm now like curious to see the original.
And like many Netflix documentaries, it reminded me of the same style of the Flat Earther documentary. Have you seen that one?
I have not. I've heard of it, but I've never actually watched it.
Oh, man. You got to see that one. So it's like, it's kind of satirical. Like, it's really not taking itself very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, the main plot line is that the guy who guessed it to the dollar, then after he did that and won everything, completely disavowed this other guy.
Oh,
and
wow.
Was like, oh no, like I did it all. And this other guy was like, no, that's not how that worked.
Yeah.
So yeah, like it was a, it was good. And it wasn't very long, which I think is the important part here.
That's, yeah. I couldn't imagine a documentary going too much longer than an hour for The Price is Right as a contestant sort of a thing.
Well, you know how it goes. Like they stretch it out and stuff if they want to, but sure. Like I said, they didn't. And I think that's what makes it.
How's your flight school going?
It's going good. So I'm getting really close to doing my first solo flight, which is a big milestone.
Yeah, hells yeah.
So the way that it works is that, if you're unfamiliar, is that you, like, so in order to get your license, you're required to have 40 hours. And it's all segmented into different categories. Well, the first half is, well, not the first half. Like, most of it you do with your instructor sitting next to you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a certain number of hours that you have to do by yourself. Obviously, you have to do a solo flight by yourself, and then you have to do solo cross countries and some other stuff. Well, so I made it, broke through a few training plateaus and overcame a few obstacles and stuff within the training environment, and I've made a lot of progress in the last couple lessons. And so we're thinking that pretty soon I'll probably do my first solo flight. And that how that'll go is, I mean, it's a really big deal. It's just like from an outside perspective, it's really not that big of a deal. Like the idea is that probably what's going to happen on my first solo day is that my instructor and I will get in the plane, we'll take off, we'll go into what's called the pattern, which is just you turn around and then you go around and you land again. And he'll see that I'm still doing it correctly. And then he'll make me taxi over. He'll hop out and he'll go, all right, you do this one by yourself. And I'll just do one pattern by myself. Ooh. But still, I mean, yeah. It's a big deal.
Yeah, hells yeah. That's awesome, man. Mm-hmm. You have to tell me what day that is.
All things considered, I'm from lesson perspective, I'm about halfway there, with requirements. With hours, I'm a little less than halfway there, but many of the requirements require multiple hours at one time with the later requirements, so right. It's not just 1 hour at a time.
Feels like you've made some really good progress though, in a shorter period of time than I would have thought. So good job.
Yeah, so whether I honestly wish we could go out more than we do, but weather really wasn't our friend at the first half of the year.
Right.
I've been doing this for about 3 months now. And with the amount of times we've been able to go out, I'm very happy with the progress. And it's just kind of ramped up from there. Like one of my big plateaus was I was having problems with my landings and just kind of getting the feel for it. But I've really overcome that and I'm landing the plane well now. So
nice, man. Nice. So, hey, when you're in those tiny trainer things, trainer planes, what's the temperature like when you get up top all high up in the sky? Is the plane insulated or I can't remember, but my impression of tiny little planes is always they got the bare bone minimum of stuff in terms of luxury for flying. I was curious how it feels or whatever up there.
Yeah. So we're in a Cessna 172, which is like the second smallest. So they make a smaller one that doesn't have a back seat, but ours has a back seat.
Okay.
Essentially. I mean, it's a nicer, more robust plane to fly around in, honestly. Anyway, it's kind of exactly as you described. It does have heat.
Okay.
But it's not pressurized at all. So you can't go above about 11,000 feet for more than 30 minutes because it doesn't have oxygen. It's not pressurized, nothing. So honestly, from my perspective, because we were flying in February, and I know it doesn't get super cold in Mississippi, but I mean, went up in some cold days, and I didn't find it to be very chilly with a low heat setting on,
okay.
Even up in the air. On the flip side, though, it does not have air conditioning.
Ooh.
So the only air is like pass-through air. So what happened? So like today is actually a really good example. So normally it's kept in a hangar, so it's at least relatively cool when you get in it. Well, because of the situation today, it had to be left outside all day. And like I said, it was almost 100 degrees a day and humid as all get out. And so you get in and it's just like sweltering hot in there. Well, you try to keep the doors and the windows open to get a little bit of air before you start going, but there's no airflow. There's no nothing because there's just a little pass-through valve that's like right above your head. And it just pulls in air from the outside as you're moving. So if you're not moving, there's no air. Once you take off, it is still warm, but like it's still really hot. Don't get me wrong. And you really need to bring water with you. A couple thousand feet up in the air is not too bad. Like you get a nice breeze going and it's not too bad.
Yeah, I was always wondering about that. Because I remember hearing, like, I guess my frame of reference is the complaints that the pilots in World War II had. I never really thought about, I'm like, yeah, you know, the commercial liners are fine because, you know, they got the whole climate control and, I guess, pressurized and everything. But I was like, oh, I never really thought about it. But, like, I don't think they have all that fancy stuff and just the trainer. Like, what?
Nope.
What's the extent of theirs? So, interesting stuff.
Yeah, it all depends on, like, how old the aircraft is. But I don't think any of the Cessnas have air conditioning. Like, the engine just isn't that big.
Yeah, well, I imagine that their idea for air conditioning is you fly the plane up high and it cools down because it's colder up there, so or cooler.
Yeah, I guess. I did have an airplane moment today, like, that I thought was really funny. So kind of part of the story for today's lesson is that I had to drive to this other airport that's across the river. And so really what we usually do is the airport where the plane usually is and its hangar is maybe 2 minutes from my house, like just right across the road.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do, though, is we usually take off from the local airport here and we fly over across the river to this other a little bit larger airport, but still pretty small. I'm in Louisiana. It's not that far away. Like you get in the air, you fly in a straight line and it's like maybe 5 minutes, maybe. But in your car, it's like a 30-minute drive. And so I had to meet him over there today instead of at the home airport here. And that went fine. I mean, I kind of chuckled about how it took longer. Well, then on the way home after we were done, there was really bad construction. And I was just like sitting on the interstate for like 20 minutes. And I was just like looking over. I'm like, God damn it. I know that it's like a 3-minute flight from here back to my house where there's no traffic at all, you know.
Oh, man.
It's like I'm sitting here on this stupid interstate waiting for people to merge into this construction.
And you
could have just flown back and dropped me off.
Yep. Wow. That's why people want to have the superpower of flight so they can avoid traffic. All right.
But yeah, so I had my lesson today and then we talked and I'm hoping to have one on Sunday and then one on Monday. Now that I've kind of broken through a few things, we're probably going to bring Brooke up as a passenger just so she can see what's going on.
Yeah, that'd be sweet.
Yeah, my instructor's like really big in on the like the whole like family aspect because it's like this is an expensive hobby. Like no matter what you're going to do with it, you kind of have to be in it together. So bring her up and have a good time.
Yeah, man. So, show off
or something like that. Yeah. Brooke gets motion sick really, really easily, which I haven't told him.
That'll be the surprise.
It's gonna be a fun time. It's gonna be a fun time.
Well, man, I wish you the best of luck. I got nothing else to talk about the podcast if you want to end it here on your sweet hobby.
Yeah, buddy. I could talk about flying and flight lessons all evening, but I think it's a good place to stop.
Yeah. All right. So let me run through the business as usual stuff. So if anyone wants to write in and talk about Game of Thrones or fantasy baseball or ask more questions about Patrick and his gift of flight, then you guys can email us at leagueofmediocregentlemen@otnmedia.org. That is leagueofmediocregentlemen@otn.org. There is no the in the beginning of this, so don't type that in. There is also a Twitter, so to confuse you guys, it's at the LOMNG podcast. So that way, you know, keeps you on your toes. If you guys want to join the OTN Discord channel, there is a Discord link in the description for the podcast. There are Twitch streams every Tuesday and Thursday at 8 p.m. Monday is the Level Up podcast with John and Joey. my streams have become a little bit more inconsistent as I sort of figure things out with what I want to do with them. But tune in at 8 p.m. and eventually something should pop on. Patreon.com/OTN is where you can go to support us or the OTN website. It helps with getting, you know, mostly right now we're getting, I guess, art stuff done and emotes for the Twitch, I guess.
Don't sound so excited.
Because I don't know. It's always
your grandfather fought and died for those emotes, son.
Yeah, it's a surprise every day. But yeah, it seems like it's eventually getting to the shows and stuff. It's just, you know, we're figuring things out as we kind of feel.
It's seeming a little weebo, I think, what you sent me the other day.
Hells yeah, because so Joey asked us about what kind of stuff we want for OTN. And my stuff was mostly Fire Emblem and Mega Man inspired, because that's all I've done is for Twitch is played either a Fire Emblem game or my annual Mega Man Legends playthrough, which we're getting kind of close for this year. So, you know, tune in, and one of these days it's going to be Mega Man Legends again, because I've been itching to play that. So yeah, Joey showed us the first of the emotes was these three. We got this redhead, screamy-looking kid. Kind of looks like someone from Fruits Basket that's going on right now. And then two blue-haired chicks who kind of look like the mixture between the things I submitted, which was Lilina from Fire Emblem and Robin from Fire Emblem. So it's kind of, it looks like someone just merged those two, like fusion-ha kind of a thing, and that's what we get there. So I thought they were cool looking. Joey's saying that there are going to be more, and some of them are actually going to be more closely inspired by what we were. So possibly actual direct characters from our choices, but we'll see. Just keep tuning in and maybe you'll get more and more emotes as we keep going on. So yeah, so that's everything, man. Guys, hopefully it won't be 6 weeks before our next episode. We should have, for this, if you're listening to this, then you'll have seen that the Disjointed Plotlines episode was put out. From all of us here at the League of Amigos Gentlemen, I've been your host, Richard Martindale. With me has been Patrick.
And me, Patrick.
Yeah, and, you know, the other guy was here, but he's left, so he, you know, if he wants his name said in the closing, he stays. But for the rest of us, everyone, have a good night, have a good rest of the week, stay at least mediocre level.
Oh, wait. After the outro, Patrick and I continued a conversation, and so I decided to include that kind of a blip into, you know, just some funny talk about our stuff, just for you guys' enjoyment, to just sort of relax and listen to. So, didn't realize we were going to be doing it until we had already started, so I will let you guys kind of listen in and hear it, starting off with Patrick talking about a tree falling in his yard, or his parents' yard. So, anyway, enjoy after the outro. Stay mediocre.
I was going to say this, and I kind of forgot to.
I sent it on Telegram.
Look at this tree.
Whenever it loads. There you go.
Holy shit. I'm glad it didn't hit anything.
It could have blown like a little the other way and would hit the house.
Yeah, really. Is there anything else on the, like, isn't there like a house on the other side too? Could have blown that way, right?
Yeah. So Jesus, the same distance tree. From the tree to my parents' house on the other side, there's another house. So
you know what's, okay, this is weird. But now I'm imagining, now that the tree's down, it really opens up your front yard.
So it used to be that, like, the property line divider between my parents' yard and their neighbors was, like, lined with trees. Well, you can see a couple years ago,
a tree fell.
Yep. And, like, that's what those logs are that they just never got rid of because my dad's lazy. And then now that tree has fallen, so I think the only ones left are there's like a bunch of evergreens down more towards the road. But yeah. It definitely does open it up a little bit.
I was going to say this when Ian was around, but I never got to. I thought I was going to put this in our opening. I might be going to Canada this summer.
Really?
Yep.
Are you going to Vancouver?
I am.
Oh,
I know. That's
make sure you bring protection.
Okay, I was like, oh man, this would have been great. I wanted to like have it so Ian was around because I know Ian would have had an equal reaction to you, and you guys would have fed off of each other.
Well, but, I don't think he remembered that Neve lived in Vancouver area.
Oh, you're right. But I think he would have honed in on the Canada part too. So I'm gonna visit Neve. I'm gonna visit. They're also in the same vicinity as Chi and Nick from the guild. They are in the Vancouver area as well, along with another guild member, Casey, who all three of them are friends. Nick and Casey actually work for the Canadian military, the Navy, actually. So they're pretty close friends. And I was gonna go visit them, visit Neve, hang out, see the sights. Get some of that maple candy I've heard so much about. I'm looking at a end of July, kind of the first couple of days of August of when I'd be going. So
nice.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. It's like the ticket to get there is $207, and I'm nice. Using miles on the way back, so it's 12. It only cost me 12,000 of my miles of my 60,000 nice. That I have right now. Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
Where'd you get all those miles from?
So my mom went to Ireland a year or two ago. And signed me up for, like, one of those free credit cards. And it was, like, American Airlines. And they were like, if you sign up through us, you'll get 50,000 free miles in the beginning.
Okay.
And my mom's like, oh, perfect. Like, you know, you hear about these things all the time, but no one ever, like, takes advantage of them because, you know, why do you need our credit card? My mom was like, you know, this would be a great kind of, like, easy gift for Richard to get for starting up another trip somewheres, and and plus it'd be a credit card that, unlike my BB&T one, which, you know, BB&T is a fine bank, blah blah blah, but like there's no rewards. That all they do is send me coupons in the mail or something. So this one has an actual, the American Airlines thing actually has rewards on it and miles, so I can actually, like, when I use it, I'm actually getting something, as opposed to, like, I'm just, like, throwing away opportunity with my BB&T Visa card, so.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So that's where I've got it. So now, it started at 50,000, it's at 60,000 now, and I'm going to use 12,000 for a return ticket, because it's, like, $200 to get to Canada, but, like, for some reason, it was, like, $300 or something, or $400 on the way back, and if I wanted to do miles, like, pure miles, it was, like, 38,000, like, freaking miles to get to Canada, and I thought it was, like, the weirdest thing.
All about dates.
I guess, but, like, Canada, like, American Airlines now considers Canada basically not international anymore. It's, like, kind of lumped it all in on North America stuff. And so the miles that they had estimated when, like, I signed up for this card and everything was, like, 50,000 was, like, basically for 50,000 miles, I could get a ticket to Japan. It would just be the two ticket. I would have to buy the way back. But that was basically where I remember gauging it. And, like, Canada was very low in the mileage of how much you have to use for that. And so when I saw the 38,000, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. You're out of your damn mind that I would ever waste 38,000 miles for a ticket there. I'd rather pay my 200 and save the 50 or the 38 as way into whatever if I ever want to go back to Japan again. Like, you can't, no way. So then the idea came to me to split it, and I would pay a much more reasonable sum of $200 to get to Canada, and then a very much reasonable sum of 12,000 miles to get back to America.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about availability. And that's what we ran into when we were trying to go to Ireland, because Brooke and I both flew business class to Ireland.
Fancy.
And if we did it the specific dates that we did it, then it was like a third of the miles than it would have been like other dates.
Right.
And so, I mean, and that's the only way that it worked. Like, if we wouldn't have gotten the mileage deal anyway that we got, then we wouldn't have been able to do it that way. Yeah, it worked out. So out of Jackson, it's really funny how prices work though, because like I had a work trip about 2-3 weeks ago, and I needed to go to central Missouri, and it's about an 8-hour drive from here. But I looked up flights, because that's always the first option for agencies. And from a flight from Jackson to like their closest airport in Missouri, it was going to be like $650 or something.
Okay.
And I was just like, I ran the math, and like, if I fly, then I mean, I don't have any problems flying. All that money goes like through the company to like American Airlines or something. But if I drive, then I get all the mileage in my pocket.
Right.
So I ran the math real quick, and I saw that they would save like $100 over flying. And I just propose it to them, like, hey, do you mind if I drive up there? This is, you'll save a little bit of money. And they're like, oh yeah, no problem. Thanks so much for like, for looking out for us like that. I'm like, ha ha ha, finger guns, no problem. And so like, I get an extra like $600 or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah. Win-win. Win-win. All aboard the win-win.
I love it.
Yeah, so I'm excited. I gotta find hotels and stuff. I'm gonna be staying with Nick and Chi at one point for like a day or two, because they're on like some ferry like in the British Columbia, somewhere's like off, like near Vancouver, but not like, basically the Fairfax version of near Vancouver or whatever, as Fairfax to Washington, D.C. Somewhere's over there, but it's like a ferry ride to get there. But they want to show me something. Like, Chi is actually more excited than anyone. She wants to show me, like, so much stuff. It's like, cool. Her whole life has been this moment waiting for me to want to come and be bored around and stuff. So, and I'm trying to schedule, coordinate, like, time with Neve, but she's going to be starting college soon, allegedly. She doesn't know exactly what that date is yet, so she's trying to figure out where she's going to be for this time. So that's the only kind of hiccup left, is sort of figuring out the schedules of everyone. Mm-hmm. But either way, I'm excited. There's a lot of stuff.
So when are you going?
It's going to be July 26th. 27th, sorry. 27th.
Man, so that's coming up.
Yeah, so which is even more so why I'm impressed with like getting a ticket for like $200. Well, $208 technically, but I'm like, oh man, I expected it, because of how close it is, to be a little bit more expensive than that, like paying that lateness fee or something. Oh no, not lateness, but procrastination fee. Oh.
Well, the idea though, Richard, is that in my experience, that procrastination fee only comes in like 2 to 3 weeks prior.
Okay.
Now, if you go super early, like months and months prior, then it can get even cheaper. But yeah, usually up till about like 3 to 4 weeks prior, it'll still be pretty cheap. And then once you hit that like 2 to 3 week mark, depending on the route, then it'll start getting ridiculously expensive. And that's a thing for us, for my company, is that we have like a 2 week refund policy, and we can't refund airplane tickets that we already buy.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not allowed to book the tickets until 2 weeks out. And so I'll look at travel to estimate, and it'll be like, oh yeah, it'll cost me $300 to go there. And then once we can actually book, it's like $650.
Holy crap.
Or like, you know, something ridiculous like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that's really good for you. And it's cool that you're using the miles. It's a nice little perk.
I know, I know.
And you get a free bag with that, too.
Oh, I did not know that. I was just willing to, like, basically, in my head, I've been basically like, well, I was going to probably pay a full ticket anyway. Now, oh, man, actually, okay, so not only now, it's like now I have covered one of the ticket costs completely, so that's money in my pocket I can use elsewhere on this trip, like hotels or bag fees. Okay, wait, I forgot the best part has nothing to do with any planning I could have ever done, but like, there was an error on my paycheck that the county figured out on its own, and all of a sudden emailed me, and I'm getting like $227 added on to my next paycheck, which I'm just nice. Like, well, there's the other ticket right there. It's like, mm-hmm. Done and done. Like, and with 20 bucks to spare.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah, now I'm feeling like, oh, this is great. Cause now I have justified as like, well, all I got to do now is just pay for the hotel and bag fees. Right. And now bag fees included on the way back. So I'm like, oh, this is great. This is much more inexpensive than I could have ever hoped for.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So speaking of which, though, are you still looking at other jobs? Or
yes. So I'm looking right now. The stuff I've been doing is just other stuff in the county, trying to find something. That way it's a little bit of an easier skip over there in terms of my mm-hmm. benefits and going through there, carrying over. And I didn't even think about this, but I'm approaching year four as a public servant, kind of a job occupation kind of a thing. And if I hit year seven, then my student loan gets paid off. Wherever it's at, it will like forgive it or whatever, that thing. So it's something that I always keep forgetting, because my job is so goddamn awful that I I'm like in my head, I'm like, nothing is worth this. Nothing, nothing is worth this job. And but then, like, as I start to go, every time I look at other jobs, I start to go through the list of stuff that I take for granted with my job, which is, you know, salary, healthcare, state retirement, 401k, and now this, like, because you're in this job field, so if you're like a teacher or a police officer or in the police department thing or a firefighter or basically anything with a county job attached to it, after 7 years you could get your student loans kind of like paid off or forgiven or whatever. There's a certain phrase that they use for it. I'm like, okay, yeah, well, exactly, if I can find a job that's still in the county in the same department area and that I could probably stomach more for, that would be great. But right now, it's just been kind of hard to find something like that. A lot of those jobs openings are predictably things that they actually, like, there's a reason why they need people for that, and it's because there's not that many people out there for these kind of jobs. So, like, programming jobs, I just don't have any programming background, or, like, forensics, I don't have any kind of law enforcement background other than, like, four and a half months of academy, and forensics is more like they also need to be probably something in the biology department to understand things. There's, I don't know, there's a lot of like high mechanical engineer kind of jobs too and stuff. So things I just woefully am unqualified for. But I'm still looking, I'm still trying to desperately find something. If there was a job that was like comparable in terms of like, what I get here, it doesn't have to be exact. If it's a little less pay or a little bit less in the benefits department, but like did something creatively, like let me stretch creative, like thinking out, like a writing gig or a just something like in terms of like asking me to be the creative thinker or having fun with a project or something like that, then I probably would give up a lot of the benefits just to do something like that instead. Because then I would be at least a little bit more happy.
Well, I mean, if you can just like, if you can find something that has a higher salary ceiling too, like that, that was the big thing when I moved from Sheets, is that like, it wasn't on paper, it wasn't great that I was giving up something immediately, but like the salary ceiling was much higher. So
yeah, that's the thing. So like, if the salary is like to the point where I'm like there, like the other day, I when I say writing gig, it's funny because I am actually kind of woefully scared. I've used now woefully twice, but scared of technical writing. Like, I don't know if I know what I'd be doing during that. It sounds super easy and it sounds brain dead easy, but like part of me is like, yeah, but what if I have to write like a 50 page manual? I've never had to sit, other than like creative writing stuff, I've never sat down and wrote 50 pages straight. I've never I don't know what I'd be even talking about. Like, or like, do they already have a guideline for it and I have to go through it? Like, is there a specific language I need to learn? I've never thought about doing formatting for technical writing. They don't teach me technical writing. And so suddenly I start panicking my head. Well, the other day I saw like a job thing asking for like technical, like a writer for technical writing. And it was like, it was either $27 or $31 an hour for technical writing was the, but it was salary paid. They just broke it down by hour. And I was just like, holy crap, for that kind of a money, then yeah, I'll be a technical writer. I'll just do whatever you want me to do. So
yeah, they make good money.
Yeah. I didn't get that job. I didn't even, nothing came back for that, but, which is unfortunate because that was one of those times where like I went all in on like not just my resume, but like I made a cover letter, I fixed up the resume, I really like attacked like the job application thing and everything, and like it wasn't one of those like, oh, I'll just submit it in and see what happens. It was like, I'm gonna try to at least put my best foot forward on this one and see what happens, and then nothing. Sure.
Well, I mean, if you're legitimately interested in the technical writing stuff, I actually do know somebody who is looking for technical writers.
Well, I am not legitimately interested, but if the pay is better, is decent,
the pay will be better.
Yeah, then in which case I am very much interested. It is not shoveling poop and dealing.
Why
with
don't
crazy
you? Why don't you send me? I mean, you don't have to do it right now, but like at some point, send me your resume, and I'll see what I can do.
Okay. Is this technical writer job thing in Mississippi or in...
No. It's in the D.C. area.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, then I will send...
As long as you don't mind commuting to, like, Herndon.
Not really. Yeah, that's fine. Still not D.C.
Yeah, no. I don't think it's downtown. It's, like, in, like, the Herndon-Sterling area.
No, in fact, I'll have to check, but there's a chance that since I mean, right now at least, I live next to a train station. I wonder if that, depending on how, I'll have to check, but there might be a way I might even make it easier of a commute for myself.
Maybe.
But you know what? Either way, it's not what I'm doing right now, which, like, it's not even, like, working in an animal shelter is annoying because it's not just the fact that, like, your daily morning is, well, time to hose down dog poop and clean cat piss out of litter boxes and stuff.
Yep.
It's, like, I mean, that sucks too, don't get me wrong. But, like, it's the constant barking that eventually just grinds on you. But, like, when the shelter actually opens and you have to deal with people, it's these people that are just, like, they come in with an idea of what, like, their expectations of what a shelter is. Like, some people will still call it a pound. And, like, the idea is they'll come in and they'll ask, are you a no-kill shelter? And they don't really know what that means, because no-kill means that you are under, I think, 10% or 12 or 10% is your euthanasia rate. And we've never gotten down there. We're like at 14%, which is really hilarious how close we are to it, despite not being a no-kill shelter. But, like, a lot of people think when they say no-kill, it means, like, everyone lives. No dog left behind.
Right.
And that's not true.
Which doesn't make any sense once you think about it.
Right. But, like, they don't want to think about it. They want to think about the principal idea in their head. And so I have to have the same conversation with every single person who comes in. And because we're Nancy Pambies, we have to say humanely euthanized. We can't say killed, just euthanized, put down, or anything like that. So I have to have this excruciatingly long sentence with these people where I'm like, no, we're not technically a no-kill shelter. The only time we ever humanely euthanize is when the dog is so aggressive that we fear for our own lives or another animal, or the dog is so sick that, like, with cancer or parvo, that it's a mercy at that point. That's a huge run-on sentence, and I have to say it every single time, because it's the only way to get these people to shut up and not feel like they're about to cry their eyes out when they find out that, like, Brutus is going to get put down. It's just like, yeah, he is, but because of the fact that when you see him trying to kill another dog, or you see him trying to kill us, suddenly your sympathy for Brutus has now gone to zero. So, So stuff like that just drives me nuts. And then now we're at the point where we have a new director, and we have this one German lady who is our behaviorist dog behavior kind of admin person. And the new director has, like, really chopped up our schedules and really, like, kind of not offered any solutions. His solution has been, well, the caretakers will get it done. And we brought in, like, a lot of problems we're having, and he's not really, like, addressing any of them anymore, and he's just being kind of a jerk about it, but in a very passive-aggressive way that kind of, like, he has already addressed himself as an antisocial person, and he's an introvert and stuff. But he's done very little to help that. Like, he doesn't try to be better. He just tries to, kind of, like, you know, you got to adjust to me, which is not very. I've described him to everyone as rigid and unapproachable. And then with him doing this, and then we have this one lady. Her name is. Normally I've had very nice conversations with her because it's funny to joke with her with German stuff, because my mom is also fairly German. Although she doesn't have an accent, Beata has an accent. But my mom is first generation. Her mom was from Germany and immigrated over here. And then my mom and her sisters, were raised here, but, you know, from a German point of view. So Beata gets really defensive anytime some program is criticized, and or anytime she is criticized. Like, she just literally cannot handle criticism. And An example would be, like, the other day, we had some dogs throw up because someone keeps feeding them, like, dog treats, a lot of dog treats. And one of the ideas I had was, like, hey, and I brought this up, and I go, hey, Piotr, like, is she has this dog walking program, and which is great because we don't have the time to always move the dogs out, that they basically pee and shit in the runs. But there's a drain system, so they're almost encouraged to do it. But like now we've got dog walkers, and so the dog walkers have this sheet that they can write in when they took the dog out, what dog they took out, and like how long they went, blah blah blah. Like it's like a good amount of details on it. And I said, hey, is there anything on the sheet about like if they gave them a treat? Because I'm starting to think that there's an overlap that people are giving without knowing it, like totally by accident, that they're just accidentally giving like multiple treats to the same dog. And now the dog's sure. Like you just see like basically milk bone colored vomit in the runs. And Biata got like super defensive about like, oh, it's not the volunteers' fault. Like it's not them that's doing it and stuff. And I'm like, it's literally a suggestion. Like I have no horse in this race other than not cleaning up vomit. She just got really weird about it. And then she'll turn around and like when it's pointed out, like, hey, you need to be a little bit more flexible. You need to be a little like receptive to criticism. She goes, oh, well, you know, that's just how I was raised because I'm German and that's what it's like there. And I go, hold the phone. No, it is not. I go, my mom is just as German as you, minus the accent. You can't just throw an entire people under the bus to excuse your shitty behavior. Like, that's not fair. Like,
they're... can and will.
And that's what she does every single time. And it drives me so much up the wall. Like, there are times, even when we're just joking around and she takes it seriously. Now, that is German. But, like... like, yeah, I was just like, you can't do this. Like, there are multiple different Germans. Like, that just sounds... racist, like almost like you're using your racism to like try to like hide behind your culture as a way to deflect the fact that you're just an asshole. Stuff like that just drives me up the wall, and I start to get really like exhausted every day. And then when I got this like employee review that wasn't even done by my supervisor, it was done by the head caretaker, the shelter manager, and this new director, who have zero interactions with me during the day. They just basically said a couple things, like, hey, he's been late a couple of days. At this point, though, everyone at the shelter is so burned out, who hasn't been late? And this is late as in, like, I show up sometimes a minute or two late. Not, like, 10 or 20 minutes or 30 minutes late. I show up, like, about a minute or two. Because, you know, maybe traffic just kind of didn't go my way that morning, and I'm always cutting it close.
Sure.
My friends would be grateful for a minute or two late from me. and I'm like, yeah, I can't argue with that. I'm not going to say that, even though I'm saying, like, oh, it's only a minute or two late. I'm saying, yeah, you got me. You're right. That is something I need to improve on.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I get you.
They go from that to things like he goes out of his way to not learn euthanasia training. And I'm like, okay, multiple things about this. First off, I don't go out of my way. No one's taught me. I have to wait for a vet to certify me. Like, I got the certification training part, but I need to have, like, the final part of the thing is to have a vet oversee your last steps about it. And we have had a very weird kind of tenuous relationship with our vet where we were very much concerned about how her dealing with animals with... like her standard and the fact that she kind of cut the corners a lot and to the point where they wouldn't let caretakers assist the vet anymore because they needed to have supervisors there to record all the things that the vet says and does. So way they could form up a case against this vet and void her contract because of the fact that this vet that we had was, had a history with other shelters in our area where she would countersue them because of the fact that they would terminate her vet. And her husband is like this hotshot lawyer guy, and that's what they would do. That was like, it felt like they were like scheming things. And so what Prince William County was like, okay, we're going to cover all of our bases. We're going to control it like to a T. That means the caretakers aren't going to be there. So that way it's not, he said, she said, it's all just supervisors. And because of that, I got gotten to do no dealings with the vet for like months because of this. And so now the head of the shelter and the director throw that in my face about this. And then like my supervisor, she's reading this and she's like got this like face on her, like she's apologizing, like, hey, I'm really sorry, I didn't write this, like they didn't let me write this, I got like nothing in say about this, there's nothing I could say, like all I'm allowed to do is read this to you and have you sign it at the bottom. She turns and she says this to me, she goes, Richard, do you not want to euthanize? And I was like, preferably not. Like, preferably not. I mean, like, do you guys like euthanizing? Is that like, how do I answer this question? Yeah. I understand, like, if I see the feral cat climbing on the ceiling and I'm thinking like it's time to start playing the Bells theme or whatever from the Exorcism, then yeah, then I might want to start learning about euthanasia. But obviously no, I don't want to. It's unpleasant work. I'm the guy who has to throw these dead bodies in the incinerator, and I'm not feeling great about that during the day. I don't want to be thinking about the fact that I'm actually the one ending the life, if I can help it. But no, I'm not going out of my way to avoid it. It's just like it hasn't happened yet. I can't, I mean, you know, just waiting for my first time.
Oh man, that's funny as shit.
But yeah, so that's been work, and like I joke about it, but it's like literally eating away at my head. It's given me a lot of like really good jokes that I think to myself, like, if I refine this, I wonder if I can get myself a tight 10 stand up where like for good solid 10 minutes I could just do stand up comedy on my terrible work environment.
I'm sure you could. Well, and especially because you guys have a pretty high turnover too, don't you?
Yeah, so they call it a burnout, a high burnout thing. But yeah, we're supposed to, it's a field that like a lot of people end up quitting, leaving or something. Right now it hasn't. It's actually been rather stable because mostly people are kind of just stuck here like me. Or even worse is we have two people who actually legitimately want to be in this field, and they're afraid to say anything like negative because of the fact that they don't want to burn any bridges. So they leave it to me, and I'm the one who always says, like, I bring up the criticisms out at meetings and stuff because I'm not afraid to burn any bridges because I have no desire to be in this field, like to move up or anything, because I just want out. But I don't mind like stating injustices when I see injustices, or saying like, hey, this hasn't been working, we should try to change something. I have no problem with that, so like I'm usually the voice behind these girls. But yeah, I'll end up sending that the resume for the technical writing things, so that way,
yeah, we'll
see what happens.
I mean, at the very least, like, just might get you an interview experience.
Yeah. Speaking of interview experiences, I had this one, it's been weighing on me forever. And I had this one job interview in DC, and it was for that one, the one for the financial, like federal financial criminal investigation, department. I can't remember what it's called, but it has a crazy acronym. During the interview, it was two people that interviewed me, and I never like having multiple people interview me because it feels like I'm being ganged up on. It doesn't feel like in the beginning, I'm always trying to say like, hey, it's like, you know, it's right to meet you. But it just, at a certain point, I'm just like, this feels, I don't know who to address. It feels like I'm being like interrogated, not interviewed. So I have this one guy who we waited on for like 10 minutes to get to the interview thing, who's like the head up guy. And of course, he's the one in charge because he got to be late. And then there's this African-American woman. She's the one who greeted me. Very nice lady. Has been waiting with me. And it's the chit-chat between us was very, like, rigid, like, awkward. Like, I couldn't get a rapport with either of them. I couldn't figure out how to talk with them. And that was compounded even worse because I did not know what to do with my eyes during this thing. Like, I tried to keep eye contact, but I kept wandering around the room, which we were in, like, a supply closet thing. So there's, like, a bunch of just stuff to, like, if you ever wanted to look at things for hours, this is the room that would just, like, grab your attention because it just was, like, constantly, like, well, what's that? What's that? What's that? Kind of looking around. But the absolute worst, and I say this in a way that, like, it's not me, being there's no feeling arised from this, but the woman had the deepest cut V in her shirt I had ever seen in a business world, and okay. It was something like I'm not trying to look at them, but when you have it such like cut this deep, it's almost like I can't believe you would wear this, like. No, she definitely is wearing that. Is it because of the way she's sitting? I'm like, nope, I think the shirt is designed to look like that. It is just, it's just there. And, like, my eyes, it just felt like my eyes would not stop, to be honest, that's where my eyes usually land for most people anyway, is the chest area or the neck. So it gives me the sense that I'm kind of looking at your eyes, but not really, so I don't have to look. Plus I just like to watch body language. For this particular moment, not a great time to have your eyes in that default position. And I feel like I felt like at a certain point they had to have known. They had to have seen it or something and figured, like, and I wondered to myself, like, oh man, I wonder if that did me in. I wonder if they think that I'm just like a perv or something, and like that's the reason I never got this job with this, like, yeah, oh man, look at him with his lecherous eyes. Like he was addressing me with his eyes, and I'm just like, here in my thought, I'm just thinking to myself, like, yeah, I can't believe she would wear this.
So, like, that's actually something I was thinking about this morning, like when we were at the bank. And it's kind of funny how these conversations line up like this, because, like, I was because I feel like if there's any criticism for millennials or like similarly generationed people, I feel like it's the whole eye contact, how to like interact socially with others type of conversation.
Yes.
Because like, I don't really care how awkward it might feel. The correct thing to do is always look at their eyes.
Right.
Like, and so like, even if you get too nervous to look at their eyes and you like have to look at their nose or something, they can't tell the difference. And so like, the worst thing ever is when you're trying to have a business meeting or something even slightly professional, and the person you're talking to is like looking at the pictures around or looking at their desk or looking at whatever. It's just like, Jesus Christ, dude, like get it together now. Yeah. Like you got to get it together.
Yep. Yeah.
And because we interact, like we all interact online, like right now, yep. I'm surfing on my phone, like I'm playing with a deck of cards, you know, whatever.
Well, that's the thing, like, it's a two-pronged attack. One is, like, we've never really had training, like, I feel like, not, I'm not laying this on my parents or any, the generation before us as parents, mm-hmm. but it just feels like the emphasis on, like, eye contact up here, boy, just wasn't as strong, with us, universally with everyone around here. Like, it was one of those things where, like, hey, my son's not doing crime. I'm fine with anything else. Like, like you could, I'll punt eye contact if I have to, if it means that I'm able to keep my son happy and not doing crime at the same time. It's a good balance I've reached here. Mm-hmm. But like, so it's not just, but it's also like, I'm so used to multitasking and doing things at the same time. Like you just said, texting and stuff that like, I am bored, like, with my eyes. Like, I'll look at their eyes, and I can hold it there for about 10 to 15 seconds before I'm like, well, what else is on TV? like, what else can I look at? And it's not like I'm losing, like, it looks terrible, because it's just like, oh, yeah, he's lost focus, he's no longer interested. It's just like, no, I'm still listening, I'm still engaged, but my eyes are, like, just observing right now. They're in observe mode and they want to collect data, and I don't want to stop them. Like, yep. So it's hard to fight against that. And there have been times where I've had really good able to keep eye contact with someone, but a lot of times it just is hard. It's just hard to fight my instinct. The best way I've been able to do is I create a game and I'm like, well, who averts their eye gaze first? And it just happened to be in this interview because, again, I was being interviewed by two people that it was almost like I had to keep darting my eyes back and forth between them. And that created this habit in my head of like, oh, well, it's fine to keep moving your eyes then. What else can we look at besides these two? Whereas maybe I would have done better if it was one-on-one. I wouldn't have gotten into a habit of moving, but it just, or maybe I'm just making it up and I'm making excuses up. All I know is the two people certainly did not help me.
Well, naturally you're going to be overthinking anything that happened if it was unsuccessful. So, I mean, I think you're fine.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that, at the very least they had the balls to call me and tell me, hey, you didn't get the job. I'm like, oh, good. I can cross this out, and I no longer have to wait for you. as opposed to some places, you just never, like, 3 months later, still nothing heard back, and you're just like, I guess that didn't go anywhere. Like, Roanoke Police, when I applied to there, nothing. Didn't hear anything back. And, again, I have to think, like, you know, because things don't go right, I'm thinking, well, what could have gone wrong? When they scheduled for an interview with them, and I was on my way down to Florida that time. It was the year where I was visiting Sarah to go see a Rays game. And I was driving down to Florida, and I was like, hey, I'm not getting back until this time, and I'm going to be down at my parents' during this period of time. That would be the best time to have the thing. And they had me scheduled for something, and I called them back, and I said, I got the date wrong. This is the date. Make sure to change it. And they go, okay, we have changed it. It's going to be Friday, and it's going to be at this time. And I said, okay, Friday at this time, I will be there. And I showed up on Friday, and I waited an hour and a half plus, I don't, it might have been longer, in the waiting room. And they finally, like, they saw all these people before me. It was only, like, two or three other people before me. And then, like, they kept keeping me there. And they finally came, like, who are you waiting for? And I was like, I'm here for an interview. And they're like, weren't you supposed to come yesterday? And I go, no, I definitely said today. And I had them repeat it to me, and I repeated it back to them today. And and the guy looked at me, he's like, nah, that doesn't sound right. And I'm like, yeah, what? And he goes, all right, well, anyway, yeah, we could do an interview now. And I'm like, don't pity interview me, like, if that's the case. And the whole thing felt like that, where it was just like, he came in, he missed it completely yesterday, it's his fault, like, we're not gonna hire this guy, like, we'll just do this to entertain him for a couple hours, like, while our lunch cooks in the microwave. Like, that's the kind of feeling that I had from these guys. And then, like, sure enough, didn't hear anything back from them, and I was like, well, thanks for letting me come down here.
You're probably referenced as the guy who came the day late as well, like, whenever they reviewed the apps.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, great.
Okay, so what do you think about the guy who came in the day late? Oh, really that great. Okay, in the pile.
Well, he already failed out of that one academy, and he was late here. Clearly, there are reasons why he failed that academy, so we're out. We don't need him here. I'm just like, oh, man. Do we even call him back? Nah, he was late. Why don't we be late calling him back?
We'll be years late. Let's calling
play Pokemon
him back.
Go, because that was when Pokemon Go was really big. Yeah, but actually, no lie, as I was waiting, people were like, they had a Pokestop there or something, and so, like, as I'm waiting, a detective and, like, another, I think it was two detectives, actually, could have been a secretary. The way she talked and walked, it made me think that she was an admin. But they were talking, actually, I think they might have been both admin. How dare I think that the guy was a detective? They were, like, talking about, like, Pokemon, and, like, these are, like, 30, 40-year-old guys or whatever, folks or whatever, and I was like, oh, I guess everyone's playing it now. I guess there's a stop here.
Yep, there you go. Who would have known?
Yeah, so that's my interview habits, or my two worst interviews.
This is like a podcast inside of a podcast.
I know, right? these are the bits I could, if I refine them, I could make into a stand-up.
Yeah, it's uncut. Like, if we ever have to do an uncut episode.
Yeah.
Just taking stories from this shit.
Yeah. it just takes us a podcast to finally get warmed up so that way we can talk about random subjects and stories. Alright, well, thanks, Pat, for the podcast and the talk.
Yeah, no problem. I'll talk to you later.
Alright, you have a good night.